see what the questions are. If there are those we can answer easily,
what's that?
Yeah. I don't even think that with 17 people on the most recent debate, I don't think they got an hour each to answer. I didn't watch it. I did not watch it. I have a new assistant who is like very eager and lovely, but he's like jumping the gun on a bunch of stuff. And I'm like, he's like, call me in the other minute so we can talk about this. And I'm like, I don't have that, like,
not
gonna
have
that.
I'm always afraid to talk into it. Still not working.
It sounds on, but it sounds loud.
Nope. It's gross.
Yeah, actually, that would be great.
Okay, so I get to do my karaoke here. Okay, so can people hear me now? Put right up to it. Okay, all right. So good afternoon, everyone. Let's go ahead and get started. My name is Sandra Heffern, and I don't have to read what my name is, but I always do. I'm the owner of Effective Health Design and a contractor with AK Health Reform. I have the honor and the privilege to welcome you to the first in a series of closer examinations, of healthcare design models with our colleagues from the lower 48 who traveled this path ahead of us. Our series is a complement to the work being done by the Department of Health and Social Services and their TA contractor, Agnew Beck. And the series will provide us all with an opportunity for a deeper look at some of the healthcare models that are being explored. Before we get started with today's presentation, I wanted to do a couple of safety moments. You know, everybody needs to find the exit closest to them, okay? And then restrooms, go out this door, turn to the right, and then the first hallway. So anything beyond that, and you're kind of on your own. So I did want to take a moment, though, to recognize the sponsors of today's discussion. The members of AK Health Reform came together shortly after the passage of the Affordable Care Act to track what was happening at a national level with this monumentous act and then the impact on Alaska. The conveners and continued members include the Hospital and Nursing Home Association, the Primary Care Association, Denali Commission, AARP, Rasmussen Foundation, Matsu Health Foundation, the Behavioral Health Association, and the Mental Health Trust. These very brilliant and dedicated members of our healthcare community continued ACA discussions in Alaska even when it wasn't popular. So please join me in a round of applause and appreciation for today's presentation. So, speaking of brilliant and dedicated people, look at the audience. So we have with us today representatives from the state of Alaska, local government, chambers of commerce, health and human service providers, advocacy groups, payers, legislators, academic folks. I was trying to say academicians, but I knew I was going to stumble over it, so I changed my mind, and then other NGOs. You were invited to participate in these forums because you're considered leaders in your respective industry. You are the ones who can influence or torpedo prospective change. Now, I know that the latter is not going to happen. You know, we're all going to embrace change. You know, changes on how we deliver services, changes on how we get paid for services, how we govern services. We're going to blend all of our funding streams, and we're going to support cross-system collaboration. Am I right? Huh? Okay. All right. So let me bring us back to reality. So the financial situation in Alaska is going to force us to do things differently. Not to be too cliche-ish about it, but let's all be part of the solution, you know, and it's like, and use our collective talents to shape our healthcare system into one that provides access to high-quality care at a sustainable price. Before I turn this over to Lori Wolf, who's standing back here, president and CEO of the 4-Acre Group, who's going to facilitate the remainder of the session, I wanted to take a couple of minutes, because we do have such a broad range of industries that are represented today, I wanted to take a minute and just kind of pass the microphone around so that everybody else in the group knew who was here. I know we made you put on name tags, but you can't always read them from a distance. So we're going to pass the microphone around, name and your affiliation. So we'll start with Representative Hawker.
Representative Mike Hawker, State of Alaska.
Nohalak Valerie Davidson, Department of Health and Social Services.
Natasha Pineda with the Mental Health Trust Authority.
Nancy Merriman, Alaska Primary Care Association.
And I'm Heidi Whalen with Agnew Beck Consulting.
Yeah, Agnew Benben with Agnew Beck.
Melissa Kemberling with the Matsu Health Foundation.
Connie Beamer with ASHA.
Allison Lee with the Alaska PCA Providers Association.
Renee Axelson, Geneva Woods Pharmacy.
Angela Ramponi with the Kenai Peninsula Borough.
John Lee from Matsu Regional Medical Center.
Bill Hogan, College of Health, University of Alaska, Anchorage.
I'm Dan Sadler, State Representative.
Roy Scheller, Hope Community Resources.
Deb Erickson, Department of Health and Social Services.
Robin Richardson, Moda Health.
Liz Vasquez, State Representative.
Jeff Baird, Rasmussen Foundation.
Christy Davis, Alaska Innovative Medicine.
Becky Holtberg caught me with my mouth full. Ashna.
Ken Helander, AARP.
Steve Ashman, Municipal Department of Health and Human Services.
Nancy Burke, Municipality of Anchorage, Mayor's Office.
David D'Amato, Alaska Primary Care Association.
Monique Martin, DHSS.
Jocelyn Pemberton, the Hospitalist Group.
Good afternoon. Bruce Bustamante with the Anchorage Chamber.
Hi, Terry O'Connor from the Anchorage Health Department.
Dan Neumeister, Search.
Jerry Jenkins, Anchorage Fairbanks Community Mental Health Services, and the Alaska Behavioral Health Association.
Good day. I'm Andy Rogers with the Alaska Chamber. And full disclosure, I already told my table, my wife and I are also part owners of Advanced Physical Therapy with clinics all around the state.
I'm Mike Hogan. I'm with the Alaska State Medical Association.
I'm Kevin Munson. I'm with Matsu Health Services in the Valley. I'm also with the Alaska Primary Care Association as a board member in the Alaska Behavioral Health Association.
Margaret Brody with the Department of Health and Social Services.
Katie Baldwin-Johnson with the Mental Health Trust Authority.
I'm Jeannie Monk with ASHNA.
Jeff Jesse with the Mental Health Trust.
Elizabeth Ripley with the Matsu Health Foundation.
Katie Bruggeman, staff to Senator Britta Gardner.
Jackie, staff to Senator Olson.
Dave Brandon, South Peninsula Behavioral Health Services and the Alaska Behavioral Health Association.
Don Bennis, Alaska Family Services and Alaska Behavioral Health Association.
Tom Chard, just Alaska Behavioral Health Association.
Heather Plusinski, Alaska Regional Hospital.
And I'm Patrick Giles, also with Alaska Regional Hospital.
You guys are an amazing group. I have really high expectations for today, so please don't disappoint me. Okay. So at this time, I want to go ahead and I think I have to hold the mic like that. But anyway, I want to turn the mic over to Lori Wolf, who's going to take us through the remainder of the day.
Are you sure? Is that it? It's hard to tell. Yeah, I think that's it, right?
Sure.
Ah, there we go. Just really close. Ah, there we go. Good afternoon, everybody. Lovely to see so many familiar faces in the room.
It's an honor and a privilege to be with you today. Most of you know the 4-Acre Group is the state nonprofit association, and we are your statewide capacity building organization. We support and strengthen nonprofits and tribal organizations around the state of Alaska. Many of our nonprofit partners are here in the room today, so lovely to see you. I was asked to facilitate our time together, and I was thrilled to do that. It's been an interesting day already. I have been on video with the state museums, all the museums across the state are all gathering in Cordova today, so I was with them this morning, so it seems appropriate for me to move from museums to healthcare. That seems like a good role for me today, and so I appreciate that, and thank you for your time and commitment today. The way that this will work is we have two fabulous speakers, which I'll introduce in a moment, who are going to share with us their model that they're using in the state of Colorado. We'll give them ample time to explain their journey and their system. And then at about 1 o'clock, we'll take a break, and you can use the restroom and refresh your water and do all of that stuff. And we understand that some of you will have to leave at that point. We hope that's not very many of you. So we'll give you a chance to do that gracefully, and then we'll come back. And we have we want to open it up to you for you to ask questions of our panelists. I have a few questions just in case you need a little warming up. But we'll have a chance for a pretty good chunk of time for you to ask questions of our panelists about the things that they're going to present to you today. And then we're going to turn that conversation and have them join you in discussion so that you can actually have a chance to ask each other questions about, does the model, will it work here in Alaska, and what do we think about that, and which parts are attractive to us, and which parts do we think are just a deal breaker, and which, you know, where are we in that process? So they'll join you in that conversation rather than just sitting in this hot seat here right here. And so that's our time today. We're officially together until 3:30. Again, we understand lots of you have a life, and you'll need to incorporate this into that. And so if you need to go and need to move and do what you need to do to make yourself comfortable and be as present as you can to this conversation. So we'll invite you to do that as we go. All right. There are a few empty seats here, so as we have people joining us, if you want to just nicely motion to your neighbor and let them know there's seats here and here, we'll welcome people as they come. Okay, so you've all been introduced before. You're all you've all had an opportunity to be on a podium before and been introduced, and so you all know what it's like when someone says, here's the resume, here's your bio that I love, tell me which parts you want me to read. My favorite part is the part where it's just mostly X'd out. So there's so much to say about these fabulous women that we have with us, but I have been instructed to X out most of the things about them. So I just want you to know there's so much more to say. But Catherine Mulready is with us. Catherine is the Chief Strategy Officer and Vice President for Legislative Policy for the Colorado Hospital Association, where she is responsible for overseeing the CHA's public policy priorities and ensuring the CHA's 100 member hospitals are well represented in policy debates at the state and national level. Prior to joining CHA, Catherine served as the Senior Policy Advisor on Health to Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, who was responsible for coordinating the administration's health policy initiatives. And there's fabulous things to say about her besides that. The one thing she said not to tell you, which I will tell you, is that she has a life outside of this. And she has two lovely dogs and a lovely husband, and they like to explore the outdoors. So it's always important to remember that we all have a life in addition to the one that we bring to work. Susan is with us as well, and I did not ask the right pronunciation of your last name, so besides mangling it, I'll ask you to say it.
Matthew. Really? Well, it depends if you're French, which I won't even try to do, but the Anglicized version is Matthew.
Okay, so Susan Matthew has more than 17 years of experience in healthcare policy and program development. Currently, she is the manager of the Medicaid Accountable Care Collaborative, also known as ACA, because we love acronyms in healthcare, don't we? She's the that program is part of the Department of Healthcare Policy and Financing. In this role, Susan leads the development and growth of one of Colorado's central healthcare reform initiatives designed to promote coordinated care and good health outcomes while controlling healthcare costs. Previously, Susan spearheaded the effort that opened Medicaid eligibility in Colorado.
to include adults without dependent children in advance of the state's larger expansion under the Affordable Care Act. Susan has also been a consultant with the Health Management Associates and Alicia Smith and Associates, and has assisted multiple states in redesigning their Medicaid programs with a primary focus on transitioning programs to managed care. Susan holds a Master's of Public Policy from Georgetown University and a bachelor's degree from Middlebury College. It's a popular space to go if you're from Alaska. Yeah. And they're here on our first day of snow, so it must be auspicious. So I'm going to turn it over to these fabulous women, and they are going to take turns presenting to you. And then again, we'll take that break and then come back for questions.
Great. So thank you, everyone, for coming and welcoming us to Alaska. It's our first trip for both of us, so we're really excited to be here. I'm going to start with a brief video that some of our staff put together a couple of years ago. Just hit play, right? Oops. Guess I'm not going to do that. Let's see. I don't work here, but I'm glad you're here. Yeah. We can skip it too. It's going to be hard. Now I think I can do it. Let's see. Can everyone hear me okay? All right. Just raise your hand or let me know. So I'm just going to take a few minutes today to talk to you about what the ACC is, kind of how we got here, what we're thinking moving forward at a very high level, and then Catherine will jump in and fill in around the gaps as well. So we developed the ACC and we started enrolling people back in 2011. It was created in It was a multi-year effort prior to that point and was primarily created in response to an unsuccessful attempt at capitated managed care in the state. We had tried that, and somewhere around 2000, the late 90s, 2000, we We were involved with multiple lawsuits, and so that we pretty much dismantled that program and had 85% of our population in unmanaged fee-for-service system. At that time, we had the highest caseload and expenditures in the history of Medicaid. I think we had about 600,000 people. We're now at 1.2 million. So every time I read that bullet, it feels a little bit awkward to me. But at that point, it really felt like we had a big group that we needed to manage. The ACC is unique, and it was developed with some pretty comprehensive stakeholder input. And because of that experience with traditional full-risk capitated managed care, we decided as a state that that was not the route that was going to work for us. So it is not a traditional managed care program. It does offer the full benefits of Medicaid, so providers are paid fee-for-service for those benefits. And it also connects members, just as it did with Megan, to medical and some of those non-medical social services that really support health and well-being. The goal is coordinated care, and a lot of that is occurring at the regional and even at the community level. We've employed several strategies to help us meet our goal of improved health, lower costs, the triple aim goals. Every member has what we call a primary care medical provider. All of the ACC members and those PCMPs belong to a local RECO, or Regional Care Collaborative Organization. And we also had unprecedented access to data from our statewide data and analytics contractors. So we really feel like those are the three pillars that are supporting this program. We are also gradually over time increasing the amount of dollars that are tied to outcomes and value as opposed to volume. So we built that iterative approach right into the strategy and the program as we designed it. Again, these are the three primary components, and I'll talk for a few minutes about each one of those. So the RECOs, we have seven RECOs around the state, and they are responsible for ensuring a medical home for every member, that PCMP. We, in the interest of being totally open and transparent about that, we have not quite met that goal. I'd say approximately 77% of our population is attributed to a medical home right now. We made the decision at the time that we were not going to assign people to a provider with whom they did not have a relationship, and so consequently, our percentage of members who have a relationship is smaller than states that have made the decision if you don't choose within a certain period of time that they're going to then make that assignment for you. The RECOs are also responsible for developing and managing a network of providers. Their formal network is really with that primary care medical providers, and they are starting over time and building out more informal networks with specialists, with some of our long-term care service providers, and some of our county agencies that help determine eligibility. They support providers. We really had a policy early on of allowing all providers who were interested in participating to participate. So we have providers that are quite sophisticated, and then we have some providers that are much smaller, that really need a different level of support. And the RECO is responsible for identifying the type of support that the provider needs with that provider and then working with them wherever they are. They also ensure that that medical management and care coordination is occurring. Sometimes the RECO provides that, and sometimes they delegate that responsibility down to the practice level. It really depends on the practice's willingness and interest in doing that and just the RECO's perspective on how that's going to work best. They report regularly to us on progress and outcomes in much the same way that states who have the more traditional managed care require deliverables and financial reporting and different activities to make sure that we have a good handle on what's going on. And they're ultimately accountable for those health outcomes and costs. I mentioned there are seven RECOs around the state. So each RECO serves a distinct region. We did draw them on around county lines. What that means in some cases is that those practices are working with multiple RECOs, and that has been a challenge for some practices. And as we look to, we are in a re-procurement phase, as we're looking to rethink some of the policies, that's one thing that we've heard a lot, is that working with multiple RECOs can be challenging for some providers. The payment model is a basic per member per month payment. Right now it fluctuates between about $8.40 and $9 for each RECO. And that is to provide some of those services that I mentioned earlier on the slide. The RECOs are also eligible for incentive payments for meeting what we call key performance indicators. There's a typo on that slide. And those have, this year we have three of them. We have a percentage of children between the ages of 3 and 9 who receive a well child check. We have an emergency room utilization metric. And then our third one is postpartum care for women 60 days post-birth. We have changed those KPIs during the course of the program. Originally, we had readmissions and high-cost imaging. We retired readmissions and high-cost imaging and then have transformed and brought on new incentives based on some of the program priorities. We continue to track and report on those retired KPIs, but we're just not paying out on them. There is a potential for shared savings. We had quite a bit of work, I would say, 2 years ago, really trying to develop a shared savings model, and quite honestly ran into some stumbling blocks with the federal approval process and other, just some other activities that suggested to us that perhaps the timing wasn't quite right to do this, but it's still something that we think about as we move the program forward. And I did say earlier that those care coordination duties can be delegated down to the practice and to the provider level. And when the RECO does that, they then pass along some of their share of that PMPM payment down to the practice level as part of their agreement to perform those activities. The primary care medical providers serve as that client-centered medical home and are really responsible for coordinating a lot of that care as well. They provide accessible, comprehensive primary care and coordinate a lot of the medical care. We don't have an administrative referral requirement, so people can go to see other providers without that referral. As we're in this RFI process and as we've been talking about what's working and what's not, that is something that I think providers sometimes struggle with, that they're accountable for the care, but they don't necessarily have the ability to manage some of that. Conversely, we heard a lot when we did originally have that requirement, we heard a lot that it actually doesn't necessarily serve the need and that there are different ways to get that communication between the providers. The PCMPs are also responsible for educating clients and promoting self-management. We have a pretty big initiative at the department with some different patient-centered care and really thinking about what's going to work for our clients. So they're helping us work through that as well. The PCMPs, administratively, they have a contract with us at the state level, and then they also have an individual contract with the RECOs. Providers also get that up per member per month payment. Right now it's $3 that we pay directly to them for the activities that we require of them in our contract. They get continued fee-for-service reimbursement, so they submit a claim for any of the services provided. They are eligible for the incentive payments. One of the ways that we have operationalized this is that the provider is only eligible for that KPI if the RECO meets their target. And so when the RECO hasn't met their target, then the practice isn't getting that payment even if they have met the threshold. So that's been a little bit of a touch point, I think, for practices and something that would be worth thinking about if you were to develop a model like this, how to best manage that. This past year, it's actually been about 15 months now, we implemented an additional program. We held back some additional dollars from that RECO PMPM to provide to providers who met certain factors. So we developed with our stakeholders 9 different factors that we felt were kind of demonstrative of an enhanced medical home model. And when the practice then demonstrates to their RECO that they're meeting 5 of those 9 factors, they will get an additional 50 cents per member per month payment above their $3 base payment. The factors are things such as after-hours care, a tracking system for specialty referrals, some behavioral health integration factors as well. And we've actually had really good success with that. I think we were at about, I'm going to get my numbers all wrong, roughly 75% of the people who are attributed to a provider are currently attributed to and have as their patient-centered medical home one of those practices that have met those additional factors. And again, there's potential for shared savings if we were to implement it with the RECOs as well. The providers also get some other benefits. They do get some help with navigating payment and administrative hurdles. Frequently, RICOs will call our internal contract managers and say, provider so-and-so is having some challenges. Can you help them navigate with your payment vendor to make sure that this hurdle can be cleared for them? They get practice support and coaching, again, in collaboration with the RICOs, kind of where they need that support. Care coordination and non-medical resource and other support for patients, so they get more help in identifying kind of where those supports are. And they also get access to our FSTAC, which is our data analytics vendor, and they provide patient and panel data on the different metrics that we're tracking. They can set limits on patient panels. One of the things that we hear is that, you know, if I join this, am I going to have to take everyone? They can establish, the way our system works is that they can establish a number that they don't want to take any more than that. The third leg of the stool is the FSTAC, our statewide data analytics contractor. And basically, the FSTAC compiles data from claims and some other sources. It's still pretty heavily dependent on claims data. They do track and report on trends in service utilization. They can provide data and do provide data to the RICOs and the PCMPs for accountability and continuous improvement efforts. One of the things that's interesting to me about the FSTAC is that when we started this program, we didn't have anything like this. This was very groundbreaking and innovative for us. Very quickly, I think we realized the limitations with just claims data. Obviously, everyone's well aware of those. We do have generally a four-month lag because we have the 3 months of run out for a lot of the claims and then a month of processing. So in terms of immediate interventions, it is somewhat delayed, but I think it has given the practices and the RICOs a better understanding of kind of where some of the touch points are, albeit looking back. So our clients right now, we have about 950,000 people who are enrolled in the program. We started out very small. The first year, I think we maxed out at about 60,000, so we have grown the program over time. Our clients are passively enrolled, which means once they're determined eligible for Medicaid, they then we identify them as part of the eligibility categories that are eligible for this program, and then we enroll them in the RICO based on the county and the zip code in which they reside. They then have 30 days prior to their enrollment to select out of the program, and then an additional 90 days after their enrollment is effective to opt out. And then every year at their birth month, they have 60 days to choose. So we are not a mandatory enrollment program. That said, our opt-out rate has been quite low. It's been about 5%. When we enroll clients, did you have a question? You know, that's a great question, and I don't have a great answer. It's a policy that we had in place prior to. I know a lot of states do that open enrollment period. I have not heard that we're rethinking that, but I think there are advantages to both. I think that having it all at once also comes with some different challenges. So when we enroll clients, we do attribute them to that PCMP when we can. So if we have a claims history, we have a pretty detailed methodology. If we can make that assignment upon enrollment, we do, and we are able to do so for quite a few of our clients. We also look at family connection, and then the client can always choose a provider if they were not assigned one, or they can choose a different provider if they were assigned one. So we don't have a lock-in to the provider at that level. Attribution has been a challenge. Beginning. It's funny, I was at the department when we rolled out this program, and then I left and went back to consulting, and then I came back in 2014, so 3 years into the program, and I went to my first stakeholder meeting, and I said, we're still talking about attribution, and it's not a problem just that we have faced. I think Oregon faces it, a lot of different entities. As you're trying to hold providers accountable, this is a really important function. We've made some changes to improve that. Without getting into a lot of detail, we're looking now at kind of when there's a – historically, we've not changed someone's enrollment. So they go to Dr. Jones when they were enrolled in 2012. It's now 2015. they're going to Dr. Smith, but in our records, they're still attributed to Dr. Jones because they have not called to say, I want to be assigned to Dr. Smith. And so we're now going in and doing some of that cleanup. We anticipate that that's going to, it's kind of a big apple. We're turning over a big bucket right now to change some of those things. I think over time, those numbers will get smaller. So we are always trying to think about how we can make those relationships stronger with understanding that providers really want to be held accountable for the patients that they're actually seeing and for whom they can impact. That said, we anticipate ongoing conversations about this. The clients get, you know, the flip side of the RICOs and the providers providing the care management and the navigation support. Those are all of the benefits for clients. They get access to educational and special programs, some non-medical community resources, care management, and some navigation support. When we developed this program, we really thought about how to make it iterative and to make improvements over time. And so this is kind of the realm of all of the different components. We started off, that's where I'm going. We started off with a really strong focus on building upon that provider, that primary care client relationship, thinking, you know, that that was a starting place for us, that we could have a strong impact there. Over time, we have recognized and are kind of building out concentric circles as we bring in greater integration with behavioral health providers. We do have a distinct and separate behavioral health delivery system. We have a full risk capitated program for behavioral health services, which predated the ACC. We retained that program and have just been working with our behavioral health and our ACC RICO partners to develop that integration. And then at the practice level, a lot of our community mental health centers and our PCMPs are doing that same work. Last year in September, we received a dual Medicare-Medicaid enrollee demonstration grant from the federal government. A year ago, we started enrolling those dually eligible clients into the ACC. We have about 33,000 of them right now who are enrolled. And so that has really pushed the RICOs and us to develop stronger relationships with our single entry points and our community center boards and our long-term service providers. We have developed with stakeholders, we developed what we're calling a SCIP, a service coordination plan, that really is designed to kind of bring all of those different care management and activities into one place. The RICOs have been working very hard to get those done. It's a big lift for them. You know, a lot of the clients are hard to find. There are multiple care coordination plans out there, and so I think it's been challenging, but it's really helped us forge new relationships with different organizations and people that the program had not necessarily pushed us to do. We have a new, relatively new adult dental benefit. We started that in July of 2014 as well, and so there's an increased emphasis and understanding of the importance of bringing dental health in. Public health is another place. We have a pretty strong county public health system. We have 64 counties across the state. They are all working very closely with our RICOs that are part of their, that are in their counties to really make sure that we are leveraging the resources that are available in the communities. And then the RICOs all work closely with their hospital partners and other partners. Data sharing, we've made some important steps, I think, although there are still problems. With getting some admit, discharge, and transfer data from the hospitals to the RICOs to support them as people are presenting and then being released to help with some of those transitions. Sir? So I think the data infrastructure piece, yes, more is required along that continuum, and certainly the next step in part is some clinical data and making sure that we can actually take that next step. The payment reform, recognizing that as we're wanting to bring in partnerships with a lot of these groups that don't necessarily have financial interest because they're not getting the KPI or some of those other things, that we need to think about how to do that. I think at the more regional level, some of the RICOs are working with a lot of their community providers via some doctors with the public health to share community integration teams and different things. So I think that that's an important structural foundation in order to keep everybody aligned and moving in the same direction. Does that answer your question? So we have, we are at one place. We have not dictated at this point that they need to pay, for example, like the long-term care piece is a good example. So we have a system within the state where the different entities may be providing care coordination already. We have not said to the RICOs as they're working on these more comprehensive coordination plans, you have to pay your community center board to do this. We've allowed them to say, in some cases, there probably is a financial transaction that's going on. In other places, it's something different. So we've allowed them to be flexible with the partnership that they need to make and how to reinforce those different things. We have not been as directive with them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I will not answer anymore. So again, initially it was building a medical network, recruiting the primary care with a focus on that PCMP piece. In the second year of the program, we implemented a full risk capitated program in 5 counties in western Colorado, which we're calling ACC Rocky Mountain Health Plans Prime. And so that was to model a different payment mechanism within a very distinct part of the state. We have lowered those PMPMs that are not tied to risk or not tied to performance and built in some more incentive payments. In year 3, we brought an MMP program for the dually eligible. We've added more dollars at risk with that 50 cents that we pulled out from the RICOs to provide to the providers. And again, that higher PMPM for those providers that meet that 9 factors. And we also developed a performance pool, which we are tying to a 30-day visit after hospitalization. I think that's my last. I talked about all of that as well. Each year we are required within the legislation that authorized this program to provide a report to the legislature. We find each year that there is better, more coordinated care and appropriate care, greater supports for self-management, fewer expensive services, hospital stays, and some unnecessary testing, and that this program has supported some of that local healthcare infrastructure. Last year, we submitted our report on November 1st. We'll submit it again this year. But last year, we found that ER visits decreased for adults and for children who had been enrolled in the program for more than 6 months as compared to those who were not enrolled. High-cost imaging services were also significantly lower, and 30-day all-cause hospital readmissions were lower. Since 2012, a time series analysis, children with disabilities, there's been a 6% increase in the number of professional care visits and also a 7% decrease in ER visits. Children with asthma had a decrease in the number of preventable services, so we really feel like we are starting to deliver and making strides towards delivering care in the most appropriate setting. And we saw some similar trends as well with adults with disabilities and adults with diabetes. So as I mentioned briefly, we are in an active reprocurement phase right now for the next version, which we are calling ACC version 2.0 for lack of a more creative title. And really, we are pushing the envelope in terms of expanding the partners that will be part of this program and thinking beyond kind of that primary care medical model, which has served us well, but it's time now to push further along. We are looking to have new partners in place July of 2017. We are actively engaged with stakeholders right now. We meet monthly to discuss different topics. In the winter, in about 6 months, 6 to 8 months from now, we will be releasing a draft request for proposal, and the idea is really to enable people to provide input on how we want to think about this program moving forward. We have announced a couple of policy decisions. We will be doing one administrative entity per region, combining the responsibilities of our regional care collaborative organizations and our behavioral health organizations. One of the things we heard from the RFI, the request for information, was that that siloed delivery system is really not serving our clients and our providers as well as it could be. As we think to align those systems, we're also thinking about, of course, the payment and how to drive some of that incentives and partnerships and improvements that we're looking for. We also are redefining our regional map. Of course, the Behavioral Health Organization regional map did not align with the ACC regional map, so we recognize that that was an important first step to align those two programs. And just a quick slide about the investments that we've made. For the fiscal year 2013-2014, we had administrative costs managing this program of just over $69 million, which included the per member per month payments as well as those incentive payments. And our net savings were about $30 million for the year. And I will take that slide down. Thank you.
So while Connie's getting me set up, I just wanted to thank Ashna for bringing us both up here. As Susan mentioned, it's our first trip up to Alaska, and it's been awesome so far. Unfortunately, we have to leave tonight, so try to figure out how to stay, but next time.
If anyone wants to shut down the airport.
Yeah, exactly. More so. I'd also just like to thank you all for being here and commend you really on having the conversation. I think Colorado, there's something in our culture from a public policy perspective that values very deeply the spirit of collaboration and coming together and having conversations. I'll be very frank with you, it's sometimes a big pain in the butt. But it's at the end of the day, I think it's that process that leads to better outcomes for projects. And so I want to certainly thank Lori, our facilitator, and just all of you for engaging in the dialogue. We'll see how we're doing here. That uncooperative mouth. And as you're brainstorming questions, I mean, I think one of the fundamental pieces that is part of that conversational aspect is that the ACC is a piece of the puzzle for health reform in Colorado, but it may be a 100-piece puzzle, and there are lots and lots of pieces. And so every single one of these programs requires an immense amount of process and financial investment and time investment to get them all up and running, and then you have to figure out how they all work together. So part of my presentation, we'll talk a little bit about the context in which Colorado sits, but as you're thinking about questions, please don't restrict yourself to the ACC. If there are other issues, other initiatives that you've heard about that you'd like to talk about, I think we have more than enough time to talk through each of those, and Susan and I both have experience working with other initiatives as well. I can see it here.
I know.
Can't see it here, but we're closer than we were. Great.
Do you want to just look at me?
Yeah.
Oh, here we go.
Okay.
I finally got the mouse to move.
Great.
It's up. Oh, I did get it.
Put it on this.
Yeah.
No pressure.
That is always the way.
Yeah, if you could just run the little slideshow.
They're right up in the upper left-hand corner. Yep, perfect.
Great. So just a little bit of context for kind of how Colorado is. We have roughly 100 hospitals and health systems, largely largely rural, but also a lot of volume located in our urban area, which is Denver metro area and then kind of the corridor along the Front Range. Just for context, how many people have been to Colorado? Awesome. Well, tourism is very important to my former employer, our governor, and we'll try to do as much trade as possible. So as you can see kind of from the patient care numbers there at the bottom, we have about 414,000 inpatient visits in hospitals altogether, 9.4 million outpatient visits. And I have a few more demographic slides. I think I'll do this one first. So that's kind of a picture of our population, very kind of hot-spotted in the Denver metro area, which is why if you look at Susan's RICO map, you can see that the outstate ones are much larger than the ones closer to Denver. They have roughly the same amount. I don't know if they all have the same amount of people, but they're designed to be distributive. So, you know, our population in Colorado is about 5+ million. The state budget spend here, this is actually the state general fund spend. Health and Human Services at about $3.5 billion and statewide at about $8 billion. What I'll say about that, though, is that I learned a lot from the ASHNA team this morning about your state budget here in Alaska. We have a whole separate budget that's not general fund. So our separate budget, our total budget, is about $8 billion for health care. That's actually just TikTok, so it's probably a little bit more, about $8 billion for healthcare and $25 billion statewide. We just have two buckets of money that we budget towards, and then Medicaid hospital visits just down there at the bottom. So in terms of that context that I mentioned of really how we've facilitated that conversation and how we've gotten where we are and the Accountable Care Collaborative being a piece of this, we have had at least a decade of very strong leadership, both in the executive branch, both Democrat and Republican governors, and the legislature, both under Republican and Democrat control, kind of flips back and forth, that have said, you know, we need to get healthcare costs under control. We need to look at how we're reforming our system. Certainly all of this predated the Affordable Care Act, but I think the trend at that point in time was like, look, we really need to deal with this at the state level because the feds aren't doing anything, right? And then 2010 things shifted and feds are doing a lot. But after we passed the big hurdles of implementation on the Affordable Care Act, we're still back in a state model and appreciate having the state flexibility to say, okay, it's really on us and we really have to figure out what we want and ask the feds to accommodate what we need in our state. So we've had a lot of bipartisan public conversations. We had a Blue Ribbon Commission on Health Reform. We currently have a kind of 2.0 version of that that's called the Colorado Commission on Affordable Health Care. They meet, you know, big public stakeholders, big meetings, and they meet monthly to say, let's look at transparency, let's look at workforce, let's look at whatever it might be from a multi-payer context. And I think that's always been a piece that's been very important to Colorado. We have a really competitive healthcare provider market and a really competitive health insurance market, which just makes for a lot of players. And so we can't drive health reform just by looking at Medicaid. You really have to look at small and large groups, self-employed, any of your union plans, that kind of stuff, to really bring everyone to the table. Because certainly from a provider perspective in the hospital world now, like, we're not going to change our behavior because 20% of the population goes one way, right? We got to look at least 50 to 80% of the population to really change how we do things. And so there has been a very considerable focus on that for us in these conversations. We have kind of done full bore ACA adoption. Again, I think on the foundation that was set in Colorado predating the ACA. So, but we do have Medicaid expansion, which is why we have 1.2 million people in Medicaid. We have a state-based health insurance exchange. We also did some considerable changes to our state insurance code to make sure that we could have an environment that's friendly to insurers, to make sure that we could follow both state and federal law. We've focused a lot of time and money on health information technology investments. I think Susan talked a little bit about the SDAC, and I'll talk a bit about that as well. But we're also redesigning our Medicaid MMIS claims processing system. We have an all-payer claims database, which has been around for 5 years and is just now getting down to kind of the what they can really provide that helps consumers figure out what healthcare costs. We have a lot of health information exchange infrastructure, and again, they're all vital pieces and they all have to work together. Figuring out how is the hard part. And then we've got a billion, I feel like, federal initiatives that we have that either the state or private partners or joint initiatives to really kind of test out certain models that are kind of driven, opportunities that are made available by the feds. Comprehensive Primary Care Initiative, we do have a $65 million state innovation model grant. It's a big project. It's a lot of money, but to be honest, the money doesn't buy what you're trying to provide at the end of the day. So it's a piece of that. And again, happy to talk about any of these. And then I just learned this morning we got another $1 million to do another project, TCPI, Transformation for Comprehensive Primary Initiative. Yeah, it's practice transformation for primary care, and a lot of Medicare ACO programs as well. And then, again, I think just on the kind of where Colorado sits and having these conversations, we're what I call a deep purple state. You know, all else being equal, we're pretty centrist, but we have deep red and deep blue. And so we've got a lot of our rural areas are very, very conservative. A lot of our urban areas are very liberal. And so just trying to balance those two ends of the political spectrum to have a conversation that ultimately gets us to somewhere where we can all work together can be very challenging. And then Susan mentioned that we have 64 counties. We have very strong local control in Colorado. It's very important. And so anything that tries to shift the balance of power between local versus state versus federal just gets complicated. And then we, like most states, have multiple agencies that are responsible for health. So we work very hard to do behavioral health integration, but it's not even Susan's agency that runs a lot of behavioral health stuff. So they have a piece of the puzzle, but not the whole thing. So just trying to negotiate some of those balances can be pretty challenging. Oh, and then I should mention, we do have a fairly large hospital provider tax in Colorado. In Colorado, we call it a hospital provider fee because tax is a special word that we don't like in the state of Colorado. but that has really enabled us to do a lot of different Medicaid investment that we would not have been able to do. And we're actually in a similar situation to Alaska, as far as I understand it, in terms of kind of having a budget crisis. We have a very strict rule around how much revenue the state of Colorado can take in and how that can be spent. And right now, thankfully, the economic recovery means we're bringing in more money, but we have a budget cap, and so we're not allowed to go over that cap. So we will be sending refunds back to taxpayers this year, but in order to pay for those refunds, we'll actually be doing budget cuts to achieve them. And so we have probably about a $100 million budget cut this year. That goes up to about $500 million for the next 5 years after this year. So it's a big chunk, but I understand that you have some equally challenging pressures, if not more so. So I think Susan, as usual, did a wonderful job talking about ACC, and I'm kind of high level. From the hospital perspective, ACC 1.0 has been a mostly primary care driven initiative, right? We understand that it's the foundation for a lot of Medicaid's efforts for health reform, but it, to be honest, doesn't impact how we get paid, and so we haven't had to pay a lot of attention. Now, there are a lot of individual hospitals that are very engaged at the local level because there are pieces of the ACC that touch hospitals. So when RICOs are very concerned about readmits or ER utilization, they're talking to our people, and that's great, but ultimately there hasn't actually been a direct incentive for hospitals to participate or a disincentive for them not to participate, and all of our, with a very competitive market in the populated areas, the incentives look a little different, and so you might have some that are much more willing to partner than others, and I think that's just a feature of where we're at. In terms of the broader philosophies on which the ACC was created, Certainly having that regional versus statewide balance, like what can really vary from region to region versus what needs to be statewide, it impacts providers and clients pretty differently. And certainly clients, or Medicaid clients or patients, they move a lot, right? They may work in a different place than where they live. Their family might be in a third place, and they might have a primary care in a fourth place and know somebody at a hospital, which puts them in a fifth place, right? And so particularly in and around the Denver metro area where the ACC lines are really small, it's easy to see how someone's just normal patterns of care don't mirror their PCMP or ACC attribution at all, right? And so how we manage that has been pretty difficult. And having providers, and obviously a provider facility would be at a single address potentially and have one ACC that they primarily work with, but we have members who, particularly in the specialty care arena, are serving folks from not only across the state but across the country as kind of a regional hub for healthcare, and are trying to manage all of the ACC systems plus Medicaid plus all their other payers. So there are some of those challenges, but I do think that fundamentally having some type of regionality or adaptability to take care of unique communities within your state is a huge value to the ACC. Just means there are new problems to work out. Second, the independent components of the ACC there, I said independent, I meant interdependent. they really do all work together and are foundational to how the ACC works. I think, as was mentioned, the data pieces and the analytics pieces really do have to evolve over time, but having that foundation of we know we can pull some information out of the system that helps us improve care for patients, massively helpful. As the program grows beyond primary care, and certainly as the program grows deeper into healthcare delivery as well as broader outside of healthcare, you got a whole lot of new partners and patients and data that you need, and it has to be clinical and claims and how those interface. It's remarkably complicated, and I give it kind of short shrift. And again, I think all of that ties back to incentives. You don't get good data unless you pay for good data to get into a system. And then, another similarity we have with Alaska is that we are building towards something from a pure fee-for-service system. So Susan mentioned that we have a carve-out for behavioral health, but other than that, nearly all of our Medicaid patients are in fee-for-service. And it's important to us that we kind of figure out where the midpoint is, not to be too managed care or too fee-for-service, but there's a whole lot in the middle, and finding out exactly what we're working towards has been a long-term process and continues to be. I think that Susan provided a great overview of the ACC, and I pulled this out of their annual report. but I think that on the procedural objectives and what the department was really trying to accomplish with the ACC, right? It's about developing an infrastructure on which broader healthcare reforms, whether they be Medicaid-centric or multi-payer, it's really important to get the pieces right, that you've got community players at the table, that you engage clients, that you engage all types of providers, and have that dialogue and a table set for people to come and have a conversation. Coordinating with other reforms, as I mentioned, like the timelines are insane and the money is insane. Just trying to figure out how all the pieces fit together. And so being flexible enough to say, for example, we're going to push reprocurement for a year so that we can align this timeline with that timeline is really important. And then figure out kind of what the key performance indicators piece looks like, and if you're going to pay for value in some way, understanding what value you're actually getting. I think that's been a really big piece. So I did some math last night in the lovely Captain Cook Hotel. So I pulled all of the various numbers from the ACC. So I think Susan said that the total savings has been about $30 million. I think the public math is slightly higher, but I think
the 30 was the last year.
Oh, perfect. Awesome. So, yeah, so 30 to 41 million for over 3 operational years of the program. Again, it's an $8 billion budget. So this is pennies. But it's in the black, right? I mean, it's certainly progress. Is it a panacea? Is it the silver bullet? No, it's a piece of the puzzle. But it is saving dollars at the end of the day. Here are some of those key performance indicators from last year. And you know, I think, I don't know if I have a laser pointer on this thing. No. Oh, yes, I do. So, you know, certainly, I mean, like there are numbers trending down, and the darkest ones on the right-hand side as you look at this are after folks have been enrolled for more than 6 months, right? So things that are short are good. You know, there are pieces of this that are a little unchanged over time, right? And so I think the trick for the as we continue to work on the ACC and continue to build those community partnerships is to pick which of these KPIs are underperforming and then figure out what the problem is. And so I'll say for like emergency room visits, if you don't have hospitals at the table, it's really hard to help fix your emergency room problems, right? And so not that hospitals haven't been at a lot of tables, but, you know, there was no concerted effort to say, like, we're going after emergency room visits. We need all the hospitals on the table. Let's go figure out what the problem is from your perspective. It was like, Rico's, let's go talk about emergency room stuff. So I think those relationships have to be built at the community level, but you also need some supports for the community conversation to happen. So ongoing progress. So Susan mentioned that she's in a re-procurement phase, and so she's restricted on what she can say about ACC 2.0 because it's not public. But I can speculate all as much as I want about ACC 2.0. I'm really happy to not be a public employee right now. But, you know, as I mentioned, I think with 1.0, very primary care-centric, right? I mean, everything revolves around the primary care medical home, primary care medical providers. That's really important, and it's wonderfully foundational. There's a lot of other components of the system that have to figure out how to integrate there. So I think that'll be a trend for 2.0. You know, the payment structure, it's not any different, right? I mean, it's moving in the right direction, but it's still fee-for-service, right? And fee-for-service plus some other money to do some good investments where we need it, that's going to be a huge piece of figuring out where we go for the second iteration. And again, figuring out like where we've done well on buy-in and community conversations and where we need to move. So as Susan mentioned, the things that we know are going to happen for 2.0 are merging our maps, if you will, for the existing RICOs that are responsible for physical health and the BHOs that are responsible for behavioral health. Those will align and there will be one entity. Regional Accountable Entity, or REA. We're getting rid of the RICO word, so we'll see how that goes. The other modifications to the regional map to make sure that they align a little bit more to very minor changes to where patient utilization actually is driven. And then in terms of payment models, really looking more at value, looking at integrating care, particularly behavioral health, but I think as Susan discussed, kind of across the care continuum. And then I think probably our biggest anxiety point at the moment is like payment might differ between regions. Like that makes the providers very, very anxious so, because they do have to work with so many different payment models so many different RICOs currently that having high variation. You want that creativity, that innovation to really be community-driven and figure out what works. At the same time, the less predictability you're providing for your private market, whether that's insurance or providers, the lower level of comfort, right, that they have engaging with the system at all. You know, I think there's tons of potential here, and this is largely stuff that I would encourage you to try to leapfrog us on if you decide to go down a Medicaid reform path or an ACC-like path. Just skip all the hard stuff and go straight to where we figured it out. Learn, take the bad lessons from us. You know, we kicked off the ACC in 2011, but the planning began long before that in the midst of a remarkable level of political uncertainty, not only about the passage of ACA, but what it looks like implementation. We had to pass several state laws to get pieces implemented. and yet ACC kind of had to truck along, regardless of whether we had expansion or regardless of whether we had an exchange. And not some of those are more important to the ACC than others, right? But having 950
yeah.
in the program now, right, we wouldn't be there without Medicaid expansion. And so setting expectations for your partners is really difficult. Certainly coordination challenges with other initiatives and just figuring out like what works and what doesn't and having to rework problems has always been challenging. I think the potential for 2.0 is really being able to say, okay, we have more certainty now than we did 5 years ago. Here's the vision. This is what we're going after, right? We've got a quarter or a fifth of the state's population, so this is what we're doing. This is what we've heard we need to do, and we're going to do it. And then kind of help everybody in the system come along through incentives. I think on the flip side of that, the danger zone of 2.0, where we've hospitals typically, and I think specialty providers and pretty much anyone outside of primary care, on the healthcare side at least, has been able to kind of sit back and watch and say, oh, that's interesting, great. We have to probably figure out how to engage because ultimately the program needs to grow. The program needs to grow its cost savings. And the cost savings, as much as there are cost savings in prevention, and there are, and in better coordinated primary care, the real savings are in fixing some pretty huge systemic issues for people who are in facilities for long periods of time that don't need to be or need a different level of care. And so there's going to have to be some shift to really dealing with more acute populations than just primary care. And the payment's going to have to follow that in order to incentivize everyone to be at the table. And so how big that is, we have no idea. I think we are very invested, all of our members and the association generally, very invested at being at the table and figuring out what that looks like. But it is putting more risk out there for members and figuring out what the multi-payer aspect looks like because, as I mentioned before, it's very hard to drive behavior with even 20% of the population, but 20% of the population. And then worrying about kind of that regional variation piece and wanting to have kind of a strong statewide infrastructure because that does provide the market certainty for our members to expand their services, be in new communities, help some of our critical access hospitals or other rural facilities that are struggling to stay open. And deliver the right kind of healthcare in their communities. So I think with that, I will turn it over to Lori.
Okay, everybody, if you want to all come back and take your seats, we're going to get started. Everybody want to come back and take your seats? Can everybody come back and take their seats? We're going to get started. It's the microphone. I think I have to do this. Ah, can everybody come back and take their seats, please? Oh, now you're off. You're off. I'm on.
Push up.
Hello, everyone. Can you all come back and take your seats, please? Hello, everyone. Can you all come back and take your seats? I'm just going to borrow this one because this one's just not working.
We'll just share. Great. Okay. I'm just going to perch and share here.
All right, everybody, we're going to get started. Come on back. Oh, I'm so happy that most of you stayed. That's fabulous. So we have a bunch of questions to ask you, probably more than we actually have time for. But you actually wanted to start off with a thought that you had, and then I'll go through the questions.
Yeah, so John, whose last name I didn't catch, where's John? Oh, right here. Asked a great question in the break that I think is probably worth answering. And the question was, what do the RICOs look like? Like, who are they? And so there are seven of them, so they're all a little different. Four out of the seven are run by insurance companies. So one is an insurance company that plays in, has traditionally played heavily in both the private and public market on the Western Slope called Rocky Mountain Health Plans. If you've followed any of the innovations and stuff centered in Grand Junction, this is the main health plan for that part of the state. And then we have three regions in the eastern part of the state that are all run by Colorado Access, which has traditionally been a Medicaid-centric health plan, but they also are selling on the exchange now. And so they're kind of in both markets. And then the other three regions are run by really local community groups that have both providers and at least a payer at the table.
Anything else on that?
Yeah, the other thing I would just add is that even those two companies that have the HMO licensure and that were and are insurance companies outside of the RICO line of business, were both Colorado-based companies, so we didn't have a lot of interest initially, or I don't know, there's lack of interest, or there weren't a lot of kind of national players at the table when we started all of this a couple of years ago. It's my sense that might change moving forward. Certainly at our stakeholder meetings, we have had representatives from some of the insurance companies who, prior to this kind of announcement about where we're heading and the use of that forum for stakeholder input, were not attending those meetings. So I think as we get bigger and the dollars are bigger, the spotlight on us is also larger.
I know you're having another conversation about Oregon's model, and this is a real differentiation factor. So Oregon went I think two general differentiation factors. First is that they came from managed care and are moving towards a more kind of broad care coordination-ish model. We came from fee-for-service and are moving to probably something similar. We're all going to meet in the middle at the end of the day. But they also had competitive CCOs, their care coordination organizations, competitive CEOs in regions. So they had a few regions that had, I think, two, maybe even three competing CCOs. I think the last time I checked, they had about half of their CCOs that were going to drop out after a couple years. So again, certainly no value judgments on either of those differentiating factors, but I think things to consider as you look at various models.
Okay, so I'm going to stand back here and use this microphone here. So the first question is, you gave advice for us to skip the hard stuff and just move on to the good stuff. So, and learn from your lessons. So could you give us a little bit of a jump start on that process? What are your first thoughts about skipping the hard stuff?
I said it.
If you do, then you answer it. And I really want to know, but we should do it.
All right, I have to take it. You may not be able to skip the hard stuff, but I think you can learn from others' wins and losses. So keep the conversation going with your partners in the lower 48. Even Hawaii has some good stuff too. So, but I do think that you have an opportunity to learn from the fact that some of us have been trying to figure this stuff out on our own for almost 10 years, right? I mean, ACC has been around since 2011, but these conversations have literally been going on for a decade. And so as we start to kind of move towards second curve, right, just like deal with the upfront stuff and say, like, look, this worked, this didn't in these other places. Yes, every state is unique and we all have our own thing, right? But it doesn't mean that you have to suffer through the same process just for the sake of suffering it. Like, learn from other people's mistakes. Go to the second curve stuff and say, hey, we're going to not only focus on all this good 1.0 stuff, but we're going to be just as experimental on the 2.0 kind of stuff, whatever that looks like for you, whether it's behavioral health integration or looking more broadly at payment reform or integrating the various kinds of payer systems you have here. I think there's tons of opportunity, but don't follow our path. Just teleport yourself to the finish line.
Well, speaking of teleporting, this is a great next question. So if politics were not at play, it's an interesting question to ask in this room, what questions would you make, what changes would you make to the program to achieve greater savings and better outcomes? Of course, we're asking that of a purple state, so that's an interesting question.
What changes would we have made? It's so hard to think of that because it is such a political place. I think we made some choices early on that I don't know that the outcome of some of those choices. I mean, one example is, you know, where we really value that patient-centered medical home, but we still have such a high percentage that aren't assigned to a provider. You know, maybe it would have been a place where we could have said, we're still going to make an assignment, even if it's just by zip code, so that we can at least get some sort of relationship established. A lot of that was from that kind of, you know, free spirit of the West perspective. Nobody's going to tell me what to do, which I'm sure you are all well familiar with. And and so I think we were maybe, and this is me speaking, not the department. I actually was not part of that decision. But in retrospect, the way that some other states have handled that is just to say, we're going to make an assignment so that you get started with something. And so I think that might have been a place where we may have been more impactful in getting those relationships started earlier. I think we also probably could have done a better job. One of the benefits of the ACC is that it is unique and it really was Colorado grown. I think one of the challenges that we have faced is because it's unique, people don't have a really strong context for what it means. People know, at least in Colorado, kind of with the experience of a full risk capitated program, so they can respond to that. We've had to do a lot of education about what the ACC is, and I think part of our early education was comparing it to what it's not. And so we continue to have challenges around people not knowing what it's called. And I don't just mean people who are new to the system. I mean people who are PCMPs who don't know what their KPIs are. And so I think, like, educate and communicate more than you could possibly imagine would be appropriate. And we just didn't – one, we probably didn't recognize how important that was because it was new for us, too. And it's hard to do. It's time and resource intensive.
I'm going to do the political thing and rephrase the question. I think to answer the question about what to change, you have to answer the question of how is politics impacting the decisions you make at the front end, right? And that seems clearer to me than what I would change. I think on the how it's impacted, there are really two themes. I think the first is that it's very hard to make bold decisions because someone is going to hate your bold decision. And I think that attribution question is a good example. It's really challenging to just kind of plant your flag, right, and drive with something and probably use up a ton of your political capital to get it done when you have a billion other priorities. So you end up kind of middling a bit and either not committing or finding the path of least resistance. And I think that sometimes that does a disservice to what we're trying to achieve writ large. I think the second piece is like the lowercase p politics. Like most of this is not partisan politics. It is politics between the primary care providers and the specialists and the doctors and the nurses and the clients and the providers and the payers. And like it's everybody else and the turf battle. And so to the extent that you can use forums to say, like, okay, I know what you really want to get out of this is to maintain status quo, but that's not going to happen. So, like, let's talk about what the reasonable path might be for you and your interest, recognizing that those interest groups exist, have a purpose, are powerful or not, whatever, like, I think it's been useful for us to be really frank about the fact that people come to the table with a perspective and that perspective is valid and that, yes, they need to protect their turf to stay in business, and hopefully we all don't go out of business because then we won't have healthcare, right? There's a good mutual interest thing that I think can be aligned.
I'll do a follow along to that, which is besides cost savings, which may or may not have shown up in the first year, are there other common themes or messages that come out of those meetings besides, so everyone's got their personal interest, but what keeps them at the table? Is it still just personal interest, or have some themes of messaging kind of emerge that keep people showing up?
Yeah, I think in my years of working with the people in Colorado who are all at the table because it's their job to be at the table, everyone really is interested in making things better, right? I mean, no one is trying to defend the system that we have. We know it doesn't make sense. It's just that the second question there is, okay, so what do we change, right? And the what do we change means somebody's rates go down, or which might mean people get fired and lose their jobs, and then there are less people to provide care or you need care. But, I mean, whatever it is, there's always a path where the change means there are negative consequences, right? And there is no path where there aren't pros and cons. And I think that's just, there's nothing to do about it. You just have to know it's there and then figure out how to walk the path.
So the next question is, when you drew the regions for the RICOs, did you align with the tribal health regions? And how do you work with tribal members who are also Medicaid enrollees and with tribal health organizations?
So we do not have an extremely active tribal population in the state of Colorado. We have two areas in the southwest corner. One of the tribes is fairly affluent. The other one is quite poor. So we didn't draw the map with that piece in mind. The upshot has been that the RICO Rocky Mountain in that region does work closely with the tribal health services and with the Indian health clinics there. We also have a clinic in Denver, which has actually just become a primary care medical provider. So I think we have different challenges with those populations. We don't have a lot of people who are seeking their services to the extent that you all do. So it's not that we marginalized or ignored it. It just didn't have to be a primary driving decision in the way we drew the maps or how we were interacting. Certainly with part of the reason that the clinic in Denver has most recently become interested in becoming a PCMP is with expansion. Of course, they were having a lot more clients, and so the dollars were starting to be there for them. But it was not a primary deciding factor in terms of how we developed the program.
Would you do that differently now, knowing what you know?
Would we have done it differently at the time?
Yeah.
Probably not. I just don't think that we have the numbers behind it to think about that. Although I think as we're moving forward, certainly the integrated care and the enhanced focus on preventive care and treating the whole person, I think that is really going to benefit the services that the Indian Health Clinic can provide.
And our tribal populations are in the high single digit thousands, maybe 10,000-12,000 people out of 5.3 million. So again, they're high. The folks that are actively affiliated with the tribes are highly concentrated in one geographic area that's not urban at all. So they're certainly, we have tribal members throughout the state, but they're They may be privately insured. To the extent they're employed, they may just be in Medicaid like anybody else, but there aren't a lot of IHS services outside of the reservation areas down in the Southwest.
Thank you. Do you feel it was wise to begin with a behavioral health carve-out and then to phase to a carve-in, which is an interesting terminology, why or why not?
So I don't actually know that I can provide that answer to that question. The decision for the behavioral health carve-out model predates my experience in Colorado by about 15 to 20 years. I think at the time, certainly the enhanced focus on behavioral health made a lot of sense. The behavioral health model that we have, we have it operating through a federal authority waiver that allows us to provide different supportive services that would not traditionally be covered by Medicaid. And so I think that we've seen a lot of great care delivered to our clients through the utilization of some of those services. I also, and this I'm saying my own personal opinion a little bit, I think that there was a time and place for enhanced focus on behavioral health as a separate entity to ensure that dollars were going towards those programs and to make sure that coverage was provided. As the thinking has evolved and we're really trying to treat the whole person, it's becoming increasingly clear, and not by responses that we received, that siloed, bifurcated system is not serving clients well, it's not serving providers well, and it's really creating a very clear distinction for people. So I don't think that we would have done it differently. I think that now is a great opportunity for us to think about what we can do to make sure that moving forward, the challenges that we continuously hear about are addressed and remedied.
Yeah, Susan's spot on. I think the other piece is if you're interested in behavioral health, I have two pieces of advice. First, figure out what's funding behavioral health, and then figure out how to make it all work together, because we have two very separate streams of funding. We have Medicaid behavioral health that, as we've talked about, is all going into managed care organizations. Then we have SAMHSA block grant funds that flow through a different state agency. They go to the same organizations at the end of the day, but they have different philosophies for providing services. They have different funding requirements. We're often paying twice for the same kind of service, but maybe delivered slightly differently, whether that's kind of double dipping or whether there are two different kinds of services that need to be provided, I don't know. But my second piece of advice is, everyone needs to start somewhere with primary care, right? Like, to really get the numbers of people engaged, you got to start with primary care. On behavioral health, do not limit yourself to primary care, because the problems for patients and for clients on the behavioral health side are typically not the primary care kind of problems, right? They're high ER utilization because folks don't have their issues under control, whether those are mental health or substance use, or medical that are complicated by mental health or substance use. And so being cognizant of that continuum of care, particularly as it relates to comorbid behavioral and physical health conditions, is so critically important. And we haven't even gotten there yet in Colorado. I think it's probably down the line of something that we need to work on. But even our SIM grant is just focused on integrating primary care and behavioral health. That's a really heavy lift. I don't want to underestimate how giant of a challenge that is. And we're still combating stigma and trying to figure out how to do prevention and, like, trying to figure out how to deliver treatment to people in a way that works for them depending on what they've got going on. But there are a lot of wasted dollars on the high acuity side of the mental health, substance use, and physical health, whatever combination folks have, there are just a lot of dollars, I think, being inappropriately used, right? Like, you can't totally save those dollars. You have to invest them in treatment, but I don't think we're investing them in the right places right now because we don't have a system that's designed to do that.
Thank you. What percent of primary care providers participate in the ACC?
There is no denominator.
And the numerator is not very good either.
This is supposed to be a trick question.
Yeah.
You know, I can't remember exactly how many providers we have. I can certainly get you the numbers. I should know that. Part of our challenge has just been in the way that we count them, to be honest. We have often counted them as the billing provider because that's how we interact with them and that's how they interact with us. And so there may be one provider at that billing ID, or it may be University Hospital, their clinics, which has I don't even know how many providers. So I can get you the closest answer that we have, but I don't want to speculate right now. So I'll write that down as something to get back to you all on. It's pretty high right now. As an example, when we look at our logic of people that we enroll into the program, we do not enroll anyone who would be eligible for the ACC except that their claims history, their relationship suggests that their primary care provider is a provider who's not part of the ACC. And right now, we have 950,000 people enrolled, and we have about 20,000 people who fall into that category that are eligible, but we don't enroll them because they have a non-contracted provider. So in terms of numbers, I don't know how many that is, but in terms of the percentage of the total population, it's pretty small.
We've also continued the Affordable Care Act had a primary care rate increase. We've continued that for an additional 18 months in Colorado. I think that helps get primary care providers to the table. They do have to meet some primary care medical home requirements on the front end, like having an electronic health record. And so I think some of our rural providers in Colorado, you may have this challenge, went to rural Colorado because they didn't want to deal with any of this stuff. And so they don't want to, moving out there does not make them want to deal with this stuff anymore. And so I think you're all going to have some folks that try to buck the trend. But I think thinking about that kind of on the front end. And then, who are you defining as primary care providers is another big question of, are we talking about primary care physicians? And even if you're talking about primary care physicians, is that OBGYNs and family docs? And, what's your universe? Does it also include nurse practitioners? We get the question all the time, does it include chiropractors? Because chiropractors sometimes deliver primary care services, right? And so there are reasons why you have to meet some certain criteria around the primary care medical home, but being really intentional about some of those definitional pieces up front and justifying it, I think can help provide a little bit of certainty to get the kind of people you need in the room.
Have you gotten to the place where you've gotten those definitions over time? Or
they're evolving, yes. Okay. Yes, part of the reason there's no denominator is that it's hard to figure out who delivers primary care in Colorado. And Matt, as Susan mentioned, kind of that Western mentality. Some people are like, my favorite legislator, not kidding you, a huge supporter of hospitals, is a Republican from rural Colorado. And he always says, my primary care physician is a nurse practitioner. Right, he says it all the time, right? Which makes our physician partners crazy. But people are very passionate about where they get their care from, whether it's a hospital or an individual sole provider. And he's a huge supporter of nurse practitioners, and that's great. We need that. But just trying to figure out some of the dynamics there can be a little challenging.
Excellent. How have you been able to integrate telemedicine into this journey?
I'm curious what you're saying.
It's evolving. I think it's certainly part of the next frontier of how we need to be delivering care, particularly kind of right care, right time, right place when you live in a rural area that doesn't have a lot of specialists. So there are lots of different, telemedicine is like saying primary care, right? No one really knows what you're talking about. So first thing is figuring out what you're talking about. These can be provider-to-provider interactions that are focused either on consultation, provider-to-provider consultations around a specific patient. They can be provider-to-provider, but in a more educational context, like New Mexico's Project Echo program that's really about increasing the capacity of primary care providers to treat more complex conditions in rural areas than they typically would be able to by consulting with specialists, but not through a consult. Or they can be direct to patient, provider to patient interactions, or frankly, peer to peer, patient to patient interactions. The questions, like delivering the services, work well in a number of contexts and across all of those different frames. The question that's, I think, far more relevant is how do you pay for it, right? And is it mandatory for the patient to participate in that if that's part of the network? Or does the patient always have a choice, right? I mean, those are the really big policy decisions. So, you know, telemedicine, I think, is a tool in the toolkit, but you just need to adapt it to whatever problem you're trying to solve.
And we do have a new program that's modeled after that, called the New Mexico ECHO program, which is focusing on pain management. We have a pretty serious opioid issue, especially in the Pueblo area, and so we are piloting just working with pain management specialists via that ECHO model, which is more of a training the provider to practice at the top of their primary care license and to provide support for them. And so we have started doing that within the state. We're working with the university to bring up more ECHO-type models with different specialty focus. And then we are also doing a smaller e-consult or doc-to-doc program, which is more of a doctor asking a specific question, one-to-one type relationship for which they can bill. So certainly our rural frontier issues are not as extensive as yours, but we have pockets where there simply are not doctors to provide the care. So by using some of these models, it is helping in some pretty targeted areas. We've not rolled it out broadly yet.
It's a little bit long. Two-part question here. So how has the move towards the ACCO model affected Colorado's healthcare workforce? What professions or certifications were sufficient? Which one were insufficient? And how is the state accommodating the necessity for adjustment?
Poorly. So workforce is a really, really hard area. I don't know of any state that's done it very well. We have done a lot of work with Washington, I'll forget what it's called, but it's the University of Washington Health. They have a little health workforce group, and then there's one down in Georgia, and there's one in New York. And those are really kind of the centers of health workforce conversation, I think, in the country. I think the biggest challenge is knowing your baseline, right? Like, who is out there providing care? I think to Susan's point, like, we can tell you, or the department could tell you, like, we have a biller, right? That biller is a hospital. How many doctors are in that hospital? How many nurses are in that hospital? So we don't have a good baseline. We also have no idea how care is being delivered today versus how it will be delivered in 5 years by the time we train half a doc or two nurses, or in 10 years by the time we train a specialist physician and a cadre of social workers, right? And so we have a lot of our projects in Colorado focus around this concept of team-based care and practicing at the top of your training. But we have some licensure rules that don't adequately reflect the full scope of training. And so one of the reasons I say we're coping with this poorly is because we still regulate health professions in a very traditional model where it is a group of people who have this specialty talking to other people who have that specialty about what people in their specialty should do, right? So we had just went through a huge scope of practice fight last year about nurse practitioners' ability to prescribe medications, right? And to be honest, the biggest conflict was over, like, whether nurses and doctors had the same level of training, right? Their training models were totally different, so they're never going to have the same thing, but were they comparable, right? We talked about it for 18 months, about just this one issue of, like, how many prescribing hours do you have, and does it look exactly the same? And if it doesn't look exactly the same, how do you make sure that someone's safe prescribing? And, like, I know a ton of like, professionals are professionals. I'm a lawyer, so I say this as someone who also is part of a profession that is a self-regulated profession. But, like, we've seen one professional, you see one professional, right? Not every doc is a great prescriber. Not every nurse is a great prescriber. Not every lawyer is a great lawyer. I'm a terrible lawyer. I don't practice law. But you know, I mean, I think at the end of the day, you kind of you have to work through some of these hard conversations. Workforce is a soapbox of mine. We have terrible data about what our workforce looks like. And it's very hard to predict what you need when the payment and delivery models are changing so fast. And we want to be adaptive, right? The last 10 years we've been worried about this giant impending nursing shortage. And then a report came out last week and it was like, oh, we're only like 3% off what we need. Oh, all right. Well, so much for 10 years of talking about nursing. Like, you know, and now I think we're all really focused on social workers and other kind of behavioral health providers, certainly, and really across the full spectrum of what behavioral health providers look like. From social workers to psychiatrists and everything in between, because we're so focused on behavioral health. But we still don't really know, like, if every doctor needs a social worker or every doctor needs a psychiatrist or something in between. It's probably something in between, but we have no idea what that looks like. So we're still trying to figure it out. Sorry for the rant.
We touched a nerve.
No, I mean, I think part of the specific question is whether the ACC has had an impact on the workforce. And I don't know that I can answer that. It's, you know, anecdotally, we hear that because there are dollars that are going to the practices that were not, for which they don't have to bill, that there are more dollars in there that are enabling them to hire a social worker, to hire a nurse, to do some of that type of work. Which perhaps has a consequence of then allowing the physician to really practice at the top of his or her license, but I don't have a good answer on we don't have a good solution on workforce. And
it's not a metric that you're tracking.
Not very well, no.
So we're going to turn to money now, because we're going to get there sooner or later, right? So how do you address cost challenges related to the availability of services, for example, urban and rural cost differences, travel for care, and just economies of scale overall between rural and urban?
Well, it's fee for service. I don't know. Certainly the ACC has not yet impacted that kind of stuff. I think those are big questions. In our healthcare delivery market right now, so just – I know I mentioned this at the very outset. We have a very competitive private health insurance industry and a very competitive healthcare system industry. So we have 5 healthcare systems, all of which have at least 3 and up to 20 facilities across the state. At the same time, we don't have a single payer that has more than 22% market share. Even with like the Anthem, Cigna, Aetna, Humana merger stuff, we're still talking about like 25% market share global. So we have a lot of, as a result of that, we have a lot of experimentation going on with ACO-like things, narrow network-type things, alternative payment models generally. There's a lot of consolidation happening in the healthcare, in the hospital market and in the healthcare market, particularly with both specialists and primary care providers, both rural and urban facilities. Just there's so much competition. That competition is driving a lot of market uncertainty, though, and so we're a fairly risk-averse state when it comes to committing to a specific model for downstream payment reform, right? So lots of experimentation, but we have no idea what's going to come out the other side of any of it. And no one has enough market share, either on the provider side or the payer side, to dictate that, right? So if you have a strong payer, if you have whatever, Blue Cross Blue Shield that has 80% of your market, they make a decision and everyone has to follow suit. Similarly, if you have 2 hospital systems and one of them decides to do something earth-shattering, the other one's going to have to react to that one way or the other, right? But here, no one's got more than 20% market share. And so you do something that you think is creative and bold and great, and you plant your flag, and then, like, reality is you might be going out of business in, like, 12 months. It's the fear. Or you'll get acquired by another system. And so, or you'll lose significant market share because you just told your people they're only allowed to go to one hospital, right? So I think there's just so much uncertainty in there. And I think that applies to Medicaid, too, that we haven't gotten that far yet in terms of how that's really impacting the issue of kind of how people get paid, because we don't have directionality.
And there is no envisioned future about the change and how the payment reform would go?
No one's planted a flag other than to say fee-for-service is bad. We're all totally on board with, like, fee-for-service is not the way of the future. We just don't know what it is.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're still grappling with that internally, what the next version will look like and where some of those payment pieces will fall. I don't have a good answer either.
So that was a two-part question. So that was the first part. The second part is how are pharmaceuticals addressed in the model?
So right now we pay I'm going to get this all wrong, but we pay pharmaceuticals in the same way that we would pay the fee for service, although it's, of course, different because it's pharmaceuticals, but it's not in any sort of global payment or capitated payment. It's a fee schedule. We do have a pretty active drug utilization review program. In building a model for the future, it's not, again, I'm not exactly sure how that's going to look, but for now, tracks with our physical healthcare delivery system, which is just pay for the drug, pay for the filling. So I don't think I answered that very well, but nothing distinct or different right now.
So we'll change to that. So how are the RICOs accountable for costs? Are they accountable for provider costs? Are around utilization costs or overall costs, or what's that accountability look like?
So the primary accountability right now is really around the tracking of the utilization and the different within the different types of services that are provided, and then the KPIs, which some of them initially when we started, we did have readmissions, ER, and high-cost imaging because those were pretty big cost drivers in the system. And in order for us to continue the program, we had to demonstrate that it was at least budget neutral initially. So they're accountable just for meeting those performance metrics and then getting the dollars. We do track cost of care, but we haven't actually paid out on that or had any sort of metric within it that does that. We explored internally last year whether we wanted to build in, we created that additional performance pool. We explored whether we wanted to build in some sort of cost of care reduction or savings that would be incentivized. And then, as I said, we did explore the shared savings initiative and just couldn't quite get that off the ground. I think so they've been kind of proxy measures with the cost piece for now. But it certainly is, I think, a place for rethinking some of that, whether we want to be more mindful about incentivizing a reduction in cost or incentivizing some different things.
Okay. Does Colorado have any liability protestation for physicians? Did I say that right? Oh, protection. Can't read my own writing. Or your writing. Protection for physicians in order to reduce the practice of defensive medicine. So I'll read that again. Does Colorado have any liability protection for physicians in order to reduce the practice of defensive medicine?
Not specific. I mean, tort reform is like massive conversation constantly ongoing. From the provider side, we all work together with our primary MedMal insurer to kind of work on that. We don't have anything that's really targeted at defensive medicine, partly because in addition to the complications of having a conversation around tort reform in the state, there's not a lot of great evidence about the extent to which, I think generally there's consensus that defensive medicine exists. It's very hard to pinpoint how much it's driving up cost and therefore how much money it would save to put in some protections, right? So we've had that conversation generally speaking in the state, but it's not something, it's not an area of high focus. We also have a very strong trial lawyer lobby at the Capitol, and I think that would probably, we might be able to get something through if we really focused on it, but there's too much other work going on.
So you might imagine that the urban-rural conversation is pretty important to us. You probably figured that out. So can you share some lessons learned around just administering the whole program, the differences between administering it in rural versus urban space?
I think one of the advantages that the program has had is that when we did go to the regional level, it really enabled them to target and work with their communities. And so even within those regions, there are urban and rural areas, of course. And so by giving the RICOs the flexibility to interact as they needed to, they were then able to target those strengths and weaknesses as necessary and as needed. The issues that the RICOs face do differ. I mean, the city and county of Denver is one region. There are 21 hospitals in that region, just in Denver. The entire kind of big southeast corner region, and I think that there are 17 counties in that region, has two hospitals. And so the way in which they're interacting at those levels is clearly very different. And we actually are implementing a program where each RICO was given some dollars to work on a project, and they were to pick a community to really focus on, to dig into. And most of the RICOs chose the most urban community in their area just because of numbers. But when we were talking with Denver and then with that East Metro area, they were literally talking about a neighborhood in order to have an impact. So I think giving them the flexibility to play with that a little bit has been a good benefit of the program, that they can figure out where those differences are.
Yeah, I mean, I think that some of the pieces on that dynamic, I'm trying to think through lessons learned here. I think I have more observations than certainly a lesson at this stage. It's just that utilization does not, as I mentioned before, like utilization does not necessarily track where people live. People come to the large cities for anything complicated, typically, because if you're in southeast Colorado, like you maybe have a critical access hospital, can they handle the kind of care that you need for whatever you got going on? Or is it cheaper, right, to go do the interstate medical tourism thing and go to Denver and stay with a relative for a week and get what you need to have done? We have some data, and if you'd like to see the pictures, I have a graph I didn't show you earlier of just how inter-regional some of that utilization is, and some of it's fairly surprising. I think the kind of redrawing of the RICO map is in recognition of at least one area where we've got it's a rural county, but it's an urban-rural county next to a rural-rural county, and they're in different RICO regions, but like 90% of the people in the rural-rural county just drive one county over, but it's aligned with a RICO that's over here, right? So, you know, we can fix that stuff as we go along, but I don't know that there's any real solution to how to do that. I think the best advantage is that the regional – either the RICO or the councils that they facilitate, like the stakeholder groups that they facilitate, and they're all required to have a group, have way more community credibility in their region than does CHA or the department or the governor's office or whatever that is in terms of that decision making. And so I think people feel heard. And there is a very dedicated force behind having innovation really wanting to be driven at the local and regional level. There are limitations to that, and so it doesn't always go as planned, but I think there's certainly some commitments to try.
Can you describe what you just kind of hinted at? I think that I heard some heads popping up for that, this notion of how that conversation goes, the community oversight versus that. Can you just lay that out for us? But each community has, has an advisory group.
Right.
Can you just describe that a little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we did put into our contracts with the RICOs. So in terms of the stakeholder engagement and kind of working at that community level, we as a department have a statewide program improvement advisory committee, which has representatives from the RICOs as well as some representatives that we appoint to it. Each RICO is also required to have a regional improvement advisory committee to then bring it down to that next level in a formal way. And I believe they also have some subcommittees to really build the community piece into it. But I think a lot of the work that's happening is happening outside of that formal structure. It really is that because they're more locally focused, albeit they're still large regions, they are able to be on the ground more. And I think we hear a lot, don't forget about, it's not just Denver, even though 4 million, literally 80% of the population lives within about a 200-mile radius down the I-25 corridor. And so I think that's one thing that we did well, is that in breaking up those regions and really breaking up the state and emphasizing the regional aspect and the community aspect, there is more credibility for them. They're able to be more local. They're able to identify where the strengths are. I mean, even within the Rocky Mountain region, that whole western slope, the way they interact in Mesa County, which is where Grand Junction is very, very different from the way they interact down in the southwest corner in Cortez. And so they have community teams that vary depending on the needs and the strengths of that community. So I think there's a formal structure, but there's a really solid informal structure that has supported that.
So to that question earlier about, like, how do you skip the hard stuff, here's a hint. So excited to have a good idea. Because I feel a little Debbie Downer. Make those planning or make those regional groups, empower them, and make them accountable for some health planning stuff in their regions. One of the challenges that we have in retrospect is that we've got these RICO regional planning groups. We've got public health improvement plans that are developed by a different regional group. We've got probably 3 or 4 different federal initiatives or other kind of pilot projects that all have like drunk the Kool-Aid on the regional versus statewide stuff, but they're all different groups, right? But that hospital CEO is going to 5 different groups all talking about health planning in their region, right? And the public health director is all going to 5 different groups talking about health planning in the region. But none of those are coordinated, and none of the cycles are coordinated. So, like, our public health improvement plans and our community health needs assessments, one's on a 5-year timeline, one's on a 3-year timeline. The questions that they ask are similar but not the same. So think of if you follow and drink the Kool-Aid on the regional versus state stuff, really give that regional scope some thought as to what they should be talking about, what they shouldn't be talking about. Like, sometimes it's better to have some state stuff, but there is a balance there. But then give them the power to make some decisions within their scope and pay them to consolidate and coordinate.
So I'm going to just ask a couple more, and then we're going to let you breathe, and we're going to turn it back this way. Last couple questions here. So if Alaska wanted to implement its own effort for the accountable care, what steps would you recommend we start taking? So that was a great way to lead off, which made me ask this question now. And which ones should we take now versus which ones should we wait and do later? And are just kind of general advice for warnings to the state about what around considerations based on your model. So kind of it's the now versus later and just overall heads up.
I think that was a great question.
That was a great one. I will ask it again to the group. I'll flag that for the group too.
Figuring out what care beyond primary care looks like, I think it can wait, but it can't wait too long, right? So access to specialists, I think, is a problem in every Medicaid program in the country. I shouldn't say problem. Is a concern in every Medicaid program in the country. But you kind of got the you have to figure out the primary care stuff first. So you can wait on the secondary, tertiary treatment stuff. Just don't wait too long. Start with primary care, but be open-minded and inclusive when you're thinking about what primary care is, because it's a lot of stuff these days, and it's getting bigger. But your primary care providers, and I've looked to the docs and other primary care folks in the room that think about this every day, like ours, we're on a whole spectrum of like, yeah, we're ready to go with this, like start paying us capitated, right? Versus like, what are you talking about? I have no idea, right? So again, similar to the professional thing, I think seen one primary care provider or seen one primary care provider network, seen one, right? And recognize that they're all on different, they're all at different places on the spectrum of how well they can adapt to changes in the system, and they need help. And we're spending a lot of money in Colorado on practice transformation, which, like, a lot of these are for-profit companies. I mean, they're small businesses, but they're for-profit companies, right? And we're essentially trying to help them adapt to their market, right? That's actually not a very free market kind of thing to do, but it's really necessary to move the market. We're not spending a whole lot of state general fund dollars there, however. So,
I think one thing to think about is I think these forms are great. I think to the extent that you can start looking at some data initially, even about practice patterns, if you're thinking about a regional approach early on, that can help guide the conversation. I think one of the challenges that we have faced in our interactions with stakeholders is that I don't think that we as a department, and so this is probably advice for the department, is being very clear about we're asking for input on this, but we're going to make the decision. And, you know, we've already made this decision, but we want to know a little bit more about the how. And so being pretty thoughtful about how and when you bring the stakeholders in so that they, one, understand what their parameters are, to know kind of where to focus their energies, if in fact the big macro decisions are going to be made kind of at the state level, then what does it mean at the micro level in terms of, okay, everybody's going to have a patient-centered medical home, but we want to hear a little bit more about what we should be looking for as we define, make that definition. And so I think looking back for us and looking forward, making sure that we're very clear with everybody involved, you know, where those parameters are and where that feedback and touch points are, I think would help us all moving forward. If you have any data on utilization, if you're thinking about regional, start looking at those. Ultimately, that's probably going to be a decision that's somewhat political, perhaps small p, because it's never going to be perfect alignment. But to that point that Catherine made earlier, you know, if you have a strong sense of where that should be based on data and just based on kind of your understanding, you know, go ahead and put that out there. I was not involved in this, but I think we redrew our RICO map something like 55 times because we would go talk to someone and then they would say, no, they should be over there. And I think we allowed ourselves to maybe get wrapped around a little bit more, and ultimately it's going to be imperfect. So that would be one, I think, piece of advice in thinking about the stakeholder meets. A lot of these things are going to happen concurrently. You're going to come up with some options and then take it to stakeholders, and then you're going to refine those options. And I think just recognizing that it's going to be messy and hard, and that that's okay, and it's going to be frustrating for people, because if it was easy, you would have done it, and we would have done it all accurately before. So,
just one last thought, because this is our last question.
We have one more. Ending with patience.
Good. Ending with patience is good. As I said at the very beginning, like, this is a piece of the puzzle. There are going to be Medicaid waivers, multi-payer conversations, whatever initiatives are of interest to communities in the state or to the state as a whole or people in this room. It's a challenge, but you kind of have to go after it, do some piloting stuff, and then pick a direction. Picking a direction part is what we haven't quite figured out yet, right? I mean, we have in some areas, but not all of them. And it's still pretty hard. We can see where we want to get to, but we can't see the road. So, you know, it's an iterative process. All of the states are going through it together. I certainly welcome you into the community in the community of states struggling to figure all this out. But we're happy to be a resource to you if we can be helpful.
So we should end with the consumer here. So what kind of patient satisfaction metrics have you paid attention to? Has there been any pushback from patients, and how have patients been incentivized or not?
So we do a CAPS survey. I cannot remember what the results are. I think one of the challenges that we face in terms of measuring patient satisfaction is that because there's, to Catherine's point, you know, the providers are seeing patients from all different levels. So kind of measuring the satisfaction just on Medicaid has not been as meaningful in terms of the comparison for those who are in the ACC versus those who are not in the ACC because it's the same doctor. By and large, I think clients have appreciated the RICO. We have a lot of stories, anecdotal stories that we collect, which, you know, I read on those days where you just want to put your head down and cry and sometimes do. Like that there are places where clients have gotten help with getting a chair in their house that enabled them to sleep, which means that they weren't in the ER every day because of acquired infections and so forth. So overall, it's been positive. The opt-out rate is low. I think in part that's because there aren't a lot of restrictions on the client. They can still go to the doctor that they want to go to, which was an important component for us. The providers, I think, sometimes feel frustrated by that, just as I said earlier, that they don't always feel that they can actually manage the individual when they can go wherever they want, whenever they want to. I think client satisfaction is such a fuzzy notion. I get the survey when I go to the doctor, and I don't know if I spend a lot of time filling it out or if I do. So I think generally it's hard to measure. We have not actually incentivized the RICOs at this point for any sort of client satisfaction improvement or measure. I mentioned earlier that last year we explored using some of those performance pool dollars towards a total cost of care improvement. Part of that discussion also was, should we look at some of the CAP surveys and see whether we want to bring in patient satisfaction? And ultimately, we decided that we were not going to for some other reasons and reasons that we want to use, ways we want to use those dollars. But we're open to figuring out how to do that a little bit better and to create that as an incentive for the RICO. And I think in the next phase, there'll be more of a focus on kind of client engagement and client involvement in the system as well.
I think it's a really important question and really important work. What I always come back to, though, is like, what's our primary purpose for doing this stuff, right? Any of this health reform stuff. And if you don't say something like the triple aim, you're wrong. So everyone's health reform stuff says improve care, improve outcomes, lower cost, right? If you don't, we need to go back to 1991. That said, you have to pick one at the expense of the other two, right? You have to. You have to prioritize them. They're all really important, but they're relative. And so, I think to the department's credit, I think in Colorado we've said patient satisfaction is not our top priority. It is still a priority, but it's not the one that we're going to pay for because it's squishy and doesn't mean just because someone's happy because they like their doctor doesn't mean they're getting good care. Right? It means their doctor's nice and maybe calls them on the weekends, right? So, and not to demean the value of patient satisfaction in the system, but it's squishier than is cost or outcomes, like you're alive. So I think that's certainly an important consideration. And as you move forward in these conversations writ large, be very conscious of the trade-offs of the triple aim, of where you put your focus and resources and what that means for the other two. If there was an intervention that got all three all on the same footing, all with success, we would all be doing it, and we're not.
Is there a state that you've learned from about that? Did you learn some lessons learned from other states to figure out which one to prioritize?
No, because I think every initiative needs to be very conscious of how it's balancing those three. And I don't think that on every initiative in Colorado we're like cost, 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 right? We're not. Some were outcomes and some were costs and some were satisfaction and some were keeping businesses afloat because we need healthcare and access in rural areas, right? So there are always mitigating factors. But I think it's important to be upfront about the trade-offs and impacts. Other states that have done this particularly well, I think Oregon, Washington, New York, Minnesota, I mean, kind of the usual players, but they all have a couple things in common, which is that they sit at a table and they talk through the pros and cons.
Thank you. So what we're going to do now is take another 10-minute break. Please stand up, stretch, get a beverage, do what you need to do. We'll come back at 35 after, and we're turning the conversation back to you to engage and find out what you're thinking about.
going to give you about one more minute if everyone wants to get their find their seats again. One more minute. All right, everybody, if everyone wants to come in and take their seats, we're going to get started. Okay, everybody, if everyone wants to come take their seats, we're going to get started on phase three of our meeting. All right, everybody, come on back. Beautiful thing about Alaska, probably about a point degree of separation from all of us. We could all talk shop all day long or find out about the weather. So come on back. Thank you. Because we ended with talking about incentives, I'm going to provide an incentive for you. If you make sure you sign up on that back table. The incentive for you is that you get the PowerPoint slides emailed to you. So please don't forget. Sandra let me know. She doesn't have everyone's contact information, so just making sure you sign that document back there. It'd be great for us. She promises she's not going to sell your name to anyone. Wrong incentive. Okay. So now it's your turn. So we've got some questions that we hope will create some great conversation with our panelists instead of at them. But they were great to be so kind to endure all of our questions. The other thing about that is that although I had a stack of questions this thick, Sandra was sitting there with another stack of questions that were this thick. So you all have lots of questions. That's fantastic. So Sandra is going to figure out how to get all the answers to those questions or at least categorize them so that we know that they're topics, and she'll talk about that at the end when we do a wrap-up at about 3:15. To talk about what next steps will look like, but we understand you have tons of questions. That's great. Yeah. The way we're going to do this is a funny microphone, so maybe some of you will just use your outside voice, but we'll do the best to pass the mic here. So the first question, and the way we'll do this is I'll ask a question. Any of you who feel so inclined to answer, we'll take turns answering, and then when that's run its course, we'll move on to the next question. We're going to do this again until about 3:15. So what components of the Colorado model were most exciting to you? Who wants to start?
Missouri loves company and all.
Right, great to hear, right? They know where they want to go. They just don't, I love that. They don't know what the road looks like. I think that's really an important thing for all of us to hear.
Thank you.
is your outside voice. Oh, look, microphone for you.
I'd like to.
Hello.
There you go.
I need to eat this thing almost.
Yeah.
To dovetail on that same idea, it seems like what you've touched on that we could apply here and we could regionalize is that there is a seems to be a good model for efficiency. I think you're talking about roughly a region that's the same size as South Central Alaska. So it's tough to think about it in the scale of the state of Alaska. But if it's regionalized, then it seems to be a great potential model to achieve efficiencies in different regions that have different needs.
Great. Thank you. We can tag team her. All right, next, someone else?
I agree with what's been said. I think it needs to be regional. And I'm not sure if we're going to have the luxury, but I really liked how they started off with getting primary care on board first, because primary care is going to be so critical to success in any type of program that's going to help manage the care for our patients. And I think for us, we're going to need to make sure that, one, we have a regional approach, and two, that we have the opportunity to get our primary care providers on board. The thing that I'm concerned about for us, though, is are we going to have the luxury of the time to go 1.0 to 2.0?
This is why I think they were telling us, right, just skip all the hard stuff and go to the really difficult stuff. Right.
Yeah, I share John's concern about time, but I think one of the things that struck me as real attractive to the model is the idea that the fundamentals of payment were reasonably constant. You added some incentives. You worked on improving coordination. You reinvested or invested into the system to build primary care capacity, to build coordination capacity. You incentivized that, but you didn't mess with as many of the elements as we might be tempted to mess with all at the same time.
Last one, something that some part of the model that was exciting for you. Okay, let's move. Oh, yeah. Sure, one more. Willing to take a stand on something, maybe utilize a little political capital, either with a capital P or a lowercase p. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, there's a lot of free flow of the data, right? Everybody could kind of, at different levels of the game, could get into the data. Yeah, impressive. So do you think the Colorado model would be a good fit for Alaska? That's another, I've kind of touched on that a little bit. But more specifically, if yes, which, how, right? So let's try to get a little bit more specific about that. So if it's a good fit, really which parts of it do you think are a good fit? Maybe just a little bit, just say a little bit more. Don't just say yes. So we'll go see you again.
Just one thing that I think with regional models is so tempting. I mean, there is such so many good things about that in terms of the local control. And I can really see from what you're describing that especially with primary care, where you want your primary care provider to be close to home, that's very tempting. I guess I'm thinking to other state processes that I've been a part of, like conflict-free case management, where we really try to think about how could we regionalize care coordination. And once you start getting into the nitty-gritty of it, gosh, it gets really complicated really quickly. I guess some things that make it complicated, here in Alaska we have a very significant tribal health system that's awesome. And their boundaries are different than the boundaries that the state draws when it draws regional boundaries. So that's like seems like it's simple, but it's really not simple to coincide those two things. And, you know, you don't really want to have parallel systems, but it's really hard to figure out how to regionalize in a way that brings them together. Mm-hmm. And then I think the other thing that at least came up in the conflict-free case management process, which is ongoing, and Sandra knows tons more about it than I do, but just the question of, like, one question I had thinking about that for you is that are there providers
if you're a primary care provider, do you have to be part of the RICO in order to bill for Medicaid services? Because that's another thing that I know came up during that process is like, well, you know, does that mean we're kind of either forcing all of our care coordinators to participate in this regional entity in some way? Do they have to subcontract? Can people still be independent, or do they have to be part of it? And that gets into that whole question around how much is government kind of telling private industry how to operate and managing their markets for them. So those are some of the things that I've experienced here that get complicated when we start thinking regionally.
Other things that make you think this might be a good model for Alaska? We'll get to the ways that it might not be in a moment, but let's stay with the positive here. That's all right. We'll get there, I promise you.
Okay, I thought we were moving on to that other next one.
Do you think the Colorado model will be a good fit for Alaska? That's where we are. Do you want to answer?
I would generally say I'm not sure.
Okay.
I think the regionalization makes a tremendous amount of sense because of the urban versus rural issues we have in our state. I do think, honestly, it feels a little bit like political soup as to some of the things that were, you know, per member per month, but we also have fee-for-service. We let patients go anywhere they want. As a provider, it's just, and from managed care background, it's like how do you, awful lot of work and really no savings. So I would like to be part of a system that really we can see some really dramatic changes that bring dramatic improved health, but also increased costs.
Thanks. We're kind of morphing into this next question too, which of course, what are the concerns that you have? So you can either give us the, what do you like about the model or what concerns do you have about it? Yeah.
One of my concerns thinking about risk is our very small population. And I'm a family doc. And the idea of taking risk, particularly for the whole community, it's the volatility, and because of that, the dangers are just too high. You know, at best, 700,000, probably going to shrink here. You know, is it applicable? That's a worry.
Have you, you know, we often talk about how things go to scale, right? How do things come back? how do you think about that when? When, for example, in Metro Denver, when they were talking about how to just operationalize it at a neighborhood, how did you deal with mitigating risk at when they were at the neighborhood level? Was that part of the dialogue?
Well, since it's not an at-risk model for them, I think that their participation interest is a little bit different because it's just at this point the upside. And the ability to which even so Rocky Mountain Prime and the five counties in the western slope, they are an at-risk model, but even they recognize that that might only work for them in that particular region, given the unique nature of that. So I think that is part of that tension is, you know, there are certainly providers who are willing and want to take on the risk. They have enough patients, they have enough expertise in the world, to your point, like that. They're used to that. They feel like they can manage it. And then there are a lot of providers who simply don't have the interest, don't feel like they can manage to the risk based on the population that they have. So I don't think we have a good answer for that one right now in terms of meeting people where they are and helping them move forward with the best approach.
But I also think that in terms of the risk conversation, and again, like there's so much between fee-for-service and managed care. There's a million things we could be talking about. But what you're looking at in terms of that critical mass for your economies of scale can vary, right? So, yeah, you don't have a lot of people, but you spend a lot of money, right? So, like, so maybe your economy of scale is how much money you spend, right? And the question, I mean, health policy people will kill me, but the question may not be how do we spend less, it may be how do we deliver the level of services for the money that we're apparently willing to spend, right? Now, I think certainly there are conversations about whether we should be spending that much. Most people would say no. But I think it just sometimes requires you to flip the script a little bit. And so if you don't have the economy of scale in your local community, like, okay, look at the whole state. Like, and if it's the whole state, sure, 700,000 people, that's plenty of people, right? But it's a different person that would hold the risk, right? And then the flow down of how you do accountability that makes sense for whatever small sector of population or holder of dollars, right, that makes sense.
Thank you.
So the perception of reality is that the pie is finite. And it looks like you're spending nearly $70 million in administrative expense to manage, administer, coordinate. At least the perception I think here in Alaska is if you're spending that amount of money on administration, it's less money being able to go to direct care or direct service. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think from our perspective, it is that what we're trying to get out of the system is the services that are not necessary or not being used appropriately, which is part of the reason that we went with that high-cost duplicative imaging as an initial metric, that in fact people probably didn't need as many of those services, or ED utilization, that is not the most appropriate place for some people to get some of the care that they're getting there without in a non-value judgmental way. If somebody's actually going for something that could be treated in a primary care setting, then we want to direct them to that primary care setting. So I think the idea, for at least for us, was yes, there's an administrative component that we were willing to upfront and spend with the thinking that it's going to drive behaviors that are going to be different for people and that are going to have some savings in places where, in fact, we probably are not spending the money wisely. Does that answer your question?
Did that answer your question? I have done that.
Well, let's turn that question back to, well, how do you think that would work here? What does that look like in Alaska?
Well, so before they answer, well, you think. I think it's important, and this is my fault, it's important to remember that the numbers I showed are only a tiny little sliver of the puzzle, right? So Colorado Medicaid runs on a roughly 3% admin budget, right? In the world of payers, that's minuscule. The national MLR standards are 15 to 20%. So that wasn't the whole administrative cost for Medicaid, but even if it was a blip in the percentage of cost, we're still spending way less on admin than a private payer for the most part. And I say we, I just mean Colorado Medicaid. But I think that's important because that data stuff, the stuff that helps you make good decisions, those incentive dollars, those are all administrative spend. Right, they're not going to medical services, but they're also what's making the system improve. And so there's a trade-off, again, like everything, there's a trade-off, but I think it's an important trade-off to recognize that sometimes you have to make the investments up front. Oh, the 3% admin spend number that I cited is probably a couple years old, but based off the entire Medicaid $8 billion budget. So 3% of $8 billion is what the state spends on its administrative costs. The RICOs certainly have their own administrative cost because they employ people to do some of this stuff. And then the lines get fuzzy, and Susan might have more information, but the lines get fuzzy sometimes on whether a care coordinator is delivering services, for example, or whether they're administrative staff, and a number of other things that are somewhere on the line between service delivery and program improvement.
So if I understand the care coordination model as you describe it, the definition of care coordination, does that include the home care concept as well? As far as, are you taking into consideration all of the services in the home and not just the hospital, acute care facilities and through the physician, like durable medical equipment and pharmacy and home health care services and personal care services? Do they manage that piece as well?
They do, yeah. So they are administering they are providing the care coordination for the clients generally, and so that is working with all of those different organizations, home health, making sure that people are getting durable medical equipment that's going to help them, the prescription drugs, the specialty access, and the hospital, coordinating it all. So all of those expenses would be part of the medical spend because they're billing still for the fee-for-service system, and then the admin spend is the management of the program that we provide, the dollars that we count as those admin dollars of the dollars that are going to the RICOs and the dollars that are going to the PCMPs. Does that answer? Okay.
So just feeding on that, so is that attractive or not attractive in Alaska?
Mm-hmm.
So that would be something that you'd want to consider here in Alaska as well.
So in Alaska, I think that one of the things that we could do is have a conversation about the cost savings and sharing those cost savings. So I think you guys have incentivized the system with the per member per month, and you've shown a pretty significant cost savings from restructuring the system. I'm curious, you have $37 to $41 million cost savings. And what I hear you say is, well, we haven't figured out how to share that with the practitioners and the folks that are doing the work beyond the PMPM. What are the plans for the $37 to $41 million then? Is it reinvesting in the system? And do you think that some cost sharing could actually improve and develop a better return on the investment? Thanks.
So we've turned back to asking you questions. I know. This is not what we wanted to do right now. Remember, we have a stack of questions, so we know you all have questions for these lovely ladies, but they really want to hear from you now about what this is going to look like or could. What are the challenges and the opportunities about implementing this project in Alaska? So I'm going to let you just simmer on that question because we're going to take you off the hot seat now. I'm going to do my facilitator job here and turn us back to, what does this look like in Alaska? Is that question a question that you would want to ask before we implemented that in Alaska? Is that a challenge for us? Is that a deal breaker for us? Is that a good thing for us? What does that look like here? So we have someone back here with a white shirt on that has the mic, and then we'll go here.
So I was actually ready to issue a concern comment.
Perfect. About Alaska? Excellent. Bring it on.
it's a concern, but it's wrapped in a question. And the concern is the involvement of commercial payers in this entity, because I'm familiar with other markets in the lower 48 where similar models have been adopted in a slightly smaller scale, but they incorporate a lot of the same mechanics. What's happened, though, is in that Medicaid space, which is intended to provide access points for an underserved population, it's collided with commercial managed care payer policy. And what's happened is we've replaced...
Thank you.
So what's happened is we've seen one problem replaced with another. We see a narrowing of networks. We see access points actually reduced, not enhanced. We see denial inventory skyrocket overnight as a form of cost savings. So my concern is when you incorporate that commercial aspect, how is that working? Are they allowed kind of carte blanche? Do they get to make their own rules? Are they guided by the Medicaid office? I'm trying to understand so that they're not going rogue and becoming a commercial managed care operation.
I really promise them we aren't going to make them answer more questions.
I'll make a quick comment that throws it right back. We haven't gotten to the payment infrastructure that makes it work like a market like that. So it doesn't matter yet. Is that our number one panic point as providers? For ACC 2.0, absolutely. Do you have to think through it? 100%. And you have to weigh, I think you always have to weigh that, right, in the development of a program. But I think for Alaska as well, I mean, how do you segregate those controls such that you don't, so that your program doesn't become self-defeating?
So clearly a concern here in Alaska. So we're going to go here, and then we'll come back over here.
Okay, so... I do want to be respectful of the process, but I also want to make sure we capitalize on opportunities.
I'm not going to let you ask this question. I'm just going to stand right here.
I will just say I think we're doing our community a disservice if we don't allow ourselves a chance to ask some of the questions about funding and about budgets. We touched on it with economies of scale, but I would like to know how you guys have approached funding and is that working for Colorado? And then we can have the conversation here, does that translate to Alaska? So I want to plant my flag with Tom's, make a bold stance on that.
Well,
Well, and I think the question is, how do you want it to work here, right? Because, I mean, Colorado has a different financial situation than we do, as does Oregon, as does, you mentioned a bunch of other states, right? So prime us up for a conversation that comes back into this room.
So I'm going to ask a follow-up question. So is the question about budget relative to healthcare spending and Medicaid, or is it relative to this program? We're at your disposal.
It's a big question. Want to walk down that path? Yeah. Okay. Let's walk down that path.
Okay. So you mentioned three areas. Don't get the big one.
So we have satisfaction, we have quality of care, and then we have cost. We get to pick one. Irrespective of where we go as a community in Alaska, I think the political battle will hinge on cost. You mentioned, and laughingly so, how many initiatives there were being pursued in Colorado, some with $65 million price tags, some with $11 million price tags. For our state budget, which, you know, far less significant than the, I think you said $7 billion, $8 billion on your healthcare budget, how would Alaska begin to approach that?
Well, that's a very good question. I think, I don't disagree with you that the fulcrum of this is cost, right? And most of us are all here because we care about cost from one end or another. The challenge, though, I think, is that cost is also your most highly politicized issue. So, if cost is really the number one and you want to forsake the others and forsake all politics, right, like you might as well go managed care and tell everyone to deal with it. And the market can scream and people can go out of business and your clients can hate you, but you're going to certainly manage costs in a very predictable way, right? It's just that that's not probably where any well-balanced group of advisors would recommend anyone go, right? And so it is a question of trade-offs and sacrifices. You know, some of the initiatives that I mentioned earlier, none of those are funded with state general fund dollars, right? We have private foundations ponying up some money. We have a lot of federal, some of these are federal government-funded programs, right? I think I did the math on this a couple years ago, and I think in 2013 we had like $400 million of federal grant money coming into the state over a four-year period just for testing stuff out, right? Sounds great if you're the state and you're worried about the state budget, and maybe if you're a state legislator. Unless you're a state legislator that wants to run for Congress someday and you care deeply about how the federal government spends its money and balances the budget, right, in which case, any federal dollars that are being spent in a way that is politically touchy are bad things, right? And so you hate the bad things regardless of whether the experiments have a long-term goal. So it's touchy, but it's also important. I mean, nothing worth doing is free.
I mean, I think I would also just add that when we started this, we did it under budget action authority. So while the savings were not large, we did have to demonstrate that we could at least maintain the status quo. So we picked some specific metrics that we thought were tied as a proxy to that reduction in cost. So it wasn't huge dollars. So while we were kind of trying to achieve all three, when we established the pay-for-performance program initially, it was tied primarily to utilization that was tied to cost. So we did kind of say this is going to be our primary thing right out of the gate in order for us to get authority to demonstrate that we can save money and continue the program. I'm also going to push back just a little on the capitated managed care saving money, because I think that some of the studies have shown that there are initial savings, but then over time those flatten out, and in fact a lot of states are now in some sort of
negotiation with the managed care plans that they selected because the rates were not sustainable in the long run. So they come in, there's some quick and initial savings, but it's not clear that in the long run that that model actually works. And I think, you know, to Catherine's point earlier, which I will agree with, is that if that was the tried and true mechanism, everybody would be doing it and we would not be having this discussion right now. So I think being mindful that there is a lot of nuance to some of these things that say if you do X, then Y will happen, yes, but remember that Z might also happen.
So I'm just going to jump in real quick and just say, so when you, so you showed us the cost savings, the net cost savings, which in relative terms was not a ton of money. How did you manage that? I mean, we need, if Alaskans need to manage that expectation around cost as well, we need to talk about how you manage the expectation of what we're really going to save, because it may turn out to be like we're Colorado, and we save a little, but we don't save a lot, but we also end in the black rather than end in the red. Right?
Yeah, that's, I was going to speak to that issue. I think when we talk about reform, which is a really overused word, we're talking about things in two different buckets. There's one which is like near-term cost containment. How do we save the state general fund money next year? And there are some things that we can do, and the department's doing some of them already. And so, but that's very different than what we're talking about here, which is long-term structural, takes years and takes deep engagement to accomplish by all, with all stakeholders. So I think we need to set expectations that, yeah, there are some things we can do in the near term that will help the state budget. They're not going to be easy things either, but these conversations around CCOs or CCOs or our things that have taken place in other states with long-term engagement with stakeholders, there is no easy button, and we are not going to push an easy button and reform our system in 6 months with limited resources. So what are the things we can do now, and how do we set up a framework so that moving forward in the future, we can continue these conversations and make forward progress on the long-term things that actually will save us the bigger dollars over time? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think part of that, too, is crafting the message around expectation, of course. And to Thea's point earlier, one of the things that was attractive, she said it was attractive about the Colorado model was the data piece. And that's expensive and very long term because you have to have baseline data and then you have to be able to track it. So first you have to create the system, then you have to actually baseline it, then you get to see, right? So we're talking about years in the making. This is a long-term conversations, as Alaskans, not always our strong suit to have long-term conversations about investing here so that we can see results here. So absolutely framing the message, framing the expectations, being realistic about the now versus the later is so critically important to this conversation.
So I just want to mention, you know, as far as how this could work for Alaska and the factors that we need to deal with.
Can you put the mic a little closer? Thank you.
The mic. Yeah. So we have a very private physician model here. There's not one large group, with the exception of, you know, a certain specialty, that really kind of owns the state. And so I think that's something to factor in. How does this work for a private enterprise? You know, how does this work on a small scale? You know, to your point, I think you guys talked about providing tools to physician practices in order for them to be successful. That's so important. You know, we have been dabbling in care coordination with Alaska Innovative Medicine, and just the infrastructure creation alone and overcoming the legal hurdles is amazing how long that takes, even in a kind of small, you know, pilot project. And so to get support from the state to remove those barriers so that private enterprise can thrive and be successful, I think it's really critical, and it's so tricky when you have all the regulations. You know, everybody's so scared of HIPAA. There's stark laws. There's all sorts of issues that really block anybody to give it, a lot of energy. So, you know, just to plug that, I'd like to know a little bit more about what that means and what tools you could provide so that it isn't just, you know, big insurance companies coming in and saying we can fill this hole and do this care coordination. You know, I'm obviously very biased, but I don't think that's a very successful model. And so I would just make sure that as we're looking at it, you know, there's not a lot of physicians in this room. I think that's super important to engage our provider community in this conversation because they're not only the caregivers, they're the business people. Those are my two thoughts.
Not all of our regional healthcare facilities are in the room either. I didn't hear anyone from Providence in the room. Maybe there's someone is, but We're missing. Yeah, this is one of three meetings. It's a journey, absolutely. Other reflections on how you think this will work, the good, the bad, the challenge of what it looks like here in Alaska. I'm going to go with Jeff, and then we'll come back. A new voice in the room here. I'll come back to you.
Well, I think it has a lot of potential. We have some real differences. Obviously, our tribal system is a big difference from what they have. To me, the biggest issue is, can we all get behind something and make it work? Because I think a lot of things could work if we're all trying to make it work. If we knock each other off the play every time we try to go in a direction, then nothing's going to work. I mean, that's the problem I have with the whole fiscal gap. There's a number of ways to get there, but if we don't agree on some way, we're definitely not going to get there. So that's my big concern, is how do we get some basic framework that we can all say, okay, this isn't perfect, but we got to try to make something work. Now let's all look at our individual interests and figure out how we can make something work. To me, that's a bigger factor for the ultimate outcome than whether this particular one is the best.
Yeah, I do think it's about acknowledging, you know, what that destination really looks like, and then picking a path, right? As even our friends in Colorado said, we still don't know what the road looks like, right? But we're willing to put the car on it and see where we go, and we're willing to do it together. That's a skill set we could learn to use in Alaska, for sure. Go ahead.
I don't know if everybody got it, but I'm a family doc. And, you know, there's a reason there aren't many of us here, and I'm eating a half a day of overhead. This is a very expensive hobby, this bizarre interest that I have. But I wouldn't want people to feel forlorn, because I think all of us feel that what we really want to do is take good care of people. And I can tell you, like, I'm on this island, and I can see or imagine where I want to be. And the question is just, how do I survive? We're a living organism. I have to cross a sea full of, from my point of view, too many predators and parasites of unbelievable numbers in order to get to the place where I can take better care of my patients. You know, these things like the second phase is to incorporate behavioral health. Of course. I mean, in fact, all of us train in residencies, and the tribal system has it incorporated in. You know, it's not a separate issue. You practice right alongside behavioral health people. They are part of the team. That's obvious. But I can't pay for that in my practice now. And we are increasingly distressed. And there are 17 docs in my practice. We see 50,000 visits. I'm part of AIM, and we're working really hard to transform things. But I can't get from one niche to the other. And that's the real problem. It's a combination of the regulatory stuff that favors the monsters and just lack of payment. You know, I hear a lot of, you know, praise for primary care. Pay us.
One of the things I didn't mention earlier, and I should have, some of our rural communities are way, I mean, this is a lot easier to do in rural America than it is to do in urban America. Like as Susan said, like Denver County has 21 hospitals. Like it doesn't matter how brilliant of a care coordinator you are or how few patients you have or how few docs you have to work with, right? You still have 21 hospitals and 3 million people. So, I think there is a huge bright light in the fact that, like, rural communities have to figure this stuff out and on low resources, right? And so they have already integrated long-term services and supports and behavioral health and public health because they have 0.25 public health nurse who also works as a PE teacher and something else, right? And the post office person. But and so they're kind of a naturally integrated system. And I think that's a real strength for Alaska, because I think you can say – you can look at your communities and figure out what they're already doing well and what they need. And if it's more money from pot A to pot B, like you can make it work. It's not easy, but you can make it work. And those conversations may need to vary from region to region across the state. But like you said earlier, like they're small numbers. That's a huge advantage, because you can really integrate everyone's point of view.
I think that's part of that, part of, to Jeff's point, right, is to figure out what are our advantages, right? What are the strengths that we actually have to, so instead of talking about it like, oh, you know, we often say, oh, rural Alaska, that's just a, such a different conversation, and we think of it as a challenge. It's actually, what I'm hearing you say is actually that's our advantage, right? And that's a great way to look at this and think about, well, what are our strengths in this conversation? Because that's likely where we're going to find more commonality and be able to plant our flag, if you will, to move forward on this journey than talking about all the things that we will maybe never agree on, right? So maybe that's our path, is to think about your perspective here about, hey, that's actually a good thing, right?
I do think that from our perspective, too, the state, some of the more innovative things are happening in those smaller communities because they have the relationships. The resources are limited, but they recognized a long time ago that they really had to get together and work on how to ensure specialty access if they needed to, or, you know, bring in their long-term care services and supports providers or their behavioral health providers. And so I think in some ways that has been a place of real success and learning for us, just that they kind of were doing it before. We gave them some of the resources and the vehicle to do it maybe in a more meaningful way.
And I put my nonprofit voice of the sector hat on. I think, well, all the major healthcare, you know, in rural Alaska, they're all nonprofits. They're all the largest healthcare employer in Alaska is a nonprofit. We have to think about, right, there's already systems and cultures in place about how we do that work, and we can build on that and find strength from that. I'll take one last comment, thought from the group, and then I'm going to hand this over to Sandra to take us to our next steps. Final comment from the crowd, something you're excited about, something you're challenged by. Thea, last word.
I think on the question of kind of what are our strengths and how do we learn, to me, our tribal health system is such a strength, and some of the things that I think we can learn there is in part how they're financed, that at least in Alaska, and Commissioner, you can totally correct me if I'm wrong here, I mean, we leverage our IHS funding with third-party billing, state grants, whatever, and within that pot, those organizations have the expertise and in some ways the autonomy to figure out how to braid those funding streams together to meet the needs of their people. And they also do operate on a regional model, and they figure out how to create those levels of care within their regions so that even in the tiniest village you have a community health aide, then you're going to have a sub-regional where you're going to have a mid-level or visiting physician, then you're going to have a lot more resources at the regional. And so they figure out how to distribute their resources so that they provide those levels of care. And then I think similarly, they are the pioneers when it comes to integration, and they're figuring out how to operate group homes for people with developmental disabilities and figure out how to do care coordination, figure out how to do behavioral health. And it, certainly there's still room to grow there, and I think because it's been fairly recent that they've been doing a lot of third-party billing, that capacity and kind of understanding the power of that is still kind of new, and that's allowing even more integration to happen. But to me, you know, they take the full risk, you know. So we do have a model here that's been happening for a long time that is on that basis, and I think we don't have to look too far to find that and to, you know, really kind of learn from that. So that's something I think is important for us to factor into these conversations.
Based on your questions, Ray, we already have figured out telehealth. We could do better, but we figured out some of that. We figured out how to integrate the home health care conversation into that. I mean, just based even on your questions, we can tell, you know, what are the pieces about Alaska that you're trying to figure out? Well, how do we fit that in? And we have some systems. They're not perfect, but we have some systems that we can build from. Mm-hmm. Last one. And on that note.
Well, one of my favorite subjects is always money, so that's a good note to end on.
So if everyone would please join me again for an appreciation for our speakers coming from Colorado. One of the things that we had talked about or heard about was that we need to have continued conversation. I am so pleased that with the number of people who came, and then for those of you that stayed for the whole afternoon. So thank you. I really do appreciate you doing that. So as I talked about at the very beginning, this is the first in a series. So our next meeting, does anybody remember when the next group is going to meet? Okay, well, on the invitations, there was the teaser that the next one is scheduled for October 20th. We'll do the same type of format, and we've invited friends from Oregon to come up and talk about their CCOs as opposed to ACCs or RCCOs. I think what we'll see in all of these models is that there's collaboration, there's coordination, and there's some type of organization, you know, whether it's a small O or a big O or a big C and a small C, whatever it is. You know, all of them have some of those components. And really what we're trying to do is to look at these different models and figure out what pieces of these models do we want for Alaska? What's going to work here? You know, we've heard that there are things in Colorado that it's like, okay, well, maybe that'll work here, but, you know, it's like our regions. I don't know. I mean, personally, I think a regional model is the way to go, but I'm not quite sure how we're going to structure that. But really what we're trying to do is to provide this community with more information so that we can make sound decisions as we're moving forward. You know, I think that, you know, Becky's comments are right on that this is long term. You know, this is not surgery. You know, this is surgery with reconstruction and rehabilitation. You know, and then eventually we're going to have what we want at the end of it. You know, but this is a long process, and I hope that all of your faces, and I have your names and I have your email addresses now, I hope to see all of you back here again. Because as I said, you guys are the leaders. You're the ones who are going to be able to shape what our future looks like in healthcare. You know, so give yourselves a round of applause for being here, and I hope to see you all back again on October 20th. Thank you.